Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from February 10th, 1999.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening, or good morning, as the case may be, across all these time zones, stretching commercially from the Tahitian, the exotic Tahitian and Hawaiian Islands. Well, I've got to get over there. Really do. All the way east to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north all the way to the pole, worldwide on the Internet. And now out about 15 light years, this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. Hello there. We're going to have a busy, busy night. Let me tell you where we're going first. From the Miami Herald, February 10th, today's edition. Headline: developer gets tough about dig. No further delays, officials are told. Developer Michael Bauman hardened his stand Tuesday with local officials trying to preserve the Miami Circle archaeological site, notifying the country and the county locally there that he will not entertain, listen to this, will not entertain any offers to buy the land or accept further construction delays. Now that's interesting. No entertainment of any offer to buy the land? Anyway, with time short and the options narrowing, Miami-Dade County Mayor Pinellas, I think it is, said he plans to call the White House today. That would have been earlier today. Federal authorities previously have said the matter is out of their hands, so this is getting really, really serious. Coming up with an update in a moment, Richard C. Hoagland, Robert Ghostwolf, and Enid Pinckney, who is the first African-American president of the Dade Heritage Trust. And as a matter of fact, she is the one who, I believe, was responsible for getting the court order that got all of this delayed, and there's more to tell about her, and we will. So all of that coming up, and in the next hour, of course, the most famous dead guy in the world, Danny and Brinkley, after last night's program, that's going to be a very, an exceptionally interesting program tonight with Danny. So stand by for that, all on tap tonight. Just continuing a little bit with this story from the Miami Herald today, the county manager told a commissioner's meeting, listen to this, Tuesday, that Bauman, the developer, his stand is now rock hard. He will not consider offers to buy the property, will not accept county reimbursement for additional delays, will not allow county engineers to study the feasibility of adjusting his construction plans to build around the site. So that must be the current worry, I would guess, as we join our guests, Richard Hoagland, Robert Ghostwolf, and Enid Pinckney. Richard, is that roughly accurate?
It is roughly accurate. There has been an increasing hardening of position since the commission meeting last Friday, and it's very curious. Normally, when someone has received the accolades that Bauman received initially,
yes,
for being bright enough to realize the significance of the find and allowing Bob Carr and his archaeologists working for the preservation people to move in since last September and uncover this 38-foot circle and really understand its uniqueness in all of North America, if not even the world, everyone was very optimistic that Mr. Bauman really was on the side of, you know, truth, justice, the American way, and, you know, understood what it is to be a hero in an era where there are fewer and fewer real heroes.
He also, I should add, on his behalf, he offers to pay whatever it takes to move the circle to a new location. He does make that offer.
The problem is that every archaeologist and every ethnologist and every group which has looked at this, ranging from Native Americans to the commission itself, the Dade County Commission, are all universally against this option because it, in essence, destroys what is an ancient cathedral, an ancient sacred temple, a point of land at the mouth of the Miami River that for at least 2,000 years, judging from the artifacts that Bob Carr has turned up, and probably a lot longer, given some of the information we're going to talk about later tonight.
2,000 years, but at minimum, that's at the birth of Christ.
Absolutely.
That's not...
And, I mean, this is like trying to move St. Paul's, or cutting up the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah, I hear you.
And one of the most tragic and poignant moments of this afternoon was an Indian woman, a Native American woman, who came very great distance and attempted to go to the fence and inveigle the guards to let her in to pray on this site. And she stood in front of about 300 people in the auditorium over at the university when Mr. Carr was giving his presentation.
Yes.
And she cried. She wept in front of all these people because Bauman has put up a double fence. He absolutely will not even let Native Americans or indigenous peoples from anywhere in the world come and venerate what is a very obviously now sacred site.
Why not? I mean, everything else given, his hardening of position, his saying he'll pay to move it. Right now, why would he not allow Native Americans on the land to pray? Now, that one I don't get. Robert Nussewolf is
here.
That
went to Robert, yes.
Yeah, Robert, do you have any answer to that?
The only thing, I spent several hours yesterday evening in Miami with the spiritual leader of the Seminole Nations,
mm-hmm.
and he also is having difficulty, and he also knows there's a lot more to this than that is there, and the only thing that we can surmise is there's something beyond what the obvious is.
Well, look, if ground-penetrating radar were brought in, then I can understand, which Richard, of course, wants done, and a lot of people want done. Then you might imagine the developer is nervous that more would be found, and then, of course, the case would be a lot tougher to plow this thing down or move it or whatever. To deal with it publicly, it would get a lot tougher. So I understand that. But what I don't understand is why... I mean, I understand it. I don't agree with it, but I understand it from his point of view. But how is his case injured by not allowing Native Americans on the side to pray? I'm sorry, I don't grasp that. It makes no sense, Art.
And yeah. He's actually creating a nightmare that I don't think he realizes the ramifications of yet.
Well, he is being advised by a public relations firm, and I think you ought to fire them because it's the most execrable advice if he's following their advice. And the only thing I can think of, and maybe Enid can contribute to this part of the discussion, is that he is terrified that if there is an image on television of elders or Native peoples praying, the image of this as a sacred cathedral to another set of traditions will be infused in that marvelous medium of television in people's hearts and minds, and the groundswell to save this in place will grow, and he wants it out of sight, out of mind as quickly as possible, and on with the $120 million project.
All right, well, that's all I've been able to imagine, too. Bad PR, he'd think. All right, Enid Pinckney is with us. She is the first African-American president of the Dade Heritage Trust, and by the way, I guess responsible, we'll ask, for the first court order that somehow got this stopped or delayed for a short time. She's also a former school principal. And hello, Enid.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Did your group, in fact, get this delayed in court, and what'd you do?
Well, actually, we filed suit to do that, but we were not awarded that opportunity. The judge did not agree.
So he actually ruled against you then?
Yes. But we feel that by so doing, it brought about the delay. Mr. Bauman did say that he would give until the 26th of this month for Mr. Carr to continue the research there. And we feel that it was the suit that helped to bring this about, and I don't know why the judge did not agree with us, except that since he said he would extend the time, maybe that's why we...
So you were a point of pressure.
Well, Okay, yes.
So you were a point of pressure. All right, Enid, why did you even make the effort? In other words, what do you believe about this circle there in Miami that moved you to take such action?
Well, we are a preservation organization, and we felt that this is what we say we do. We try to preserve our heritage, and we try to preserve our culture.
Those are worthy goals. What do you think you're preserving in this case is what I'm asking you.
Well, what we think that we are preserving is a contribution to all of us by Native Americans who left either something scientific or they left a mystery for us to try to understand their civilization. And, of course, we cannot understand their civilization unless we study the civilization.
Nor can we understand how old it is, I suppose, until we study it further.
Right, right. And that's another reason why we want to preserve it. We certainly don't want to see a parking lot covering it, because then we will not have the opportunity to learn
what it is,
what it's all about, and that is something that's very important to us.
Enid, I understand you were a former school principal. Where?
Well, I was assistant principal, really, at South Miami. When I went there, I was there for 20 years. When I went there, it was a junior high school, and then they turned it into a middle school, but it's South Miami Middle School, which is located in South Miami, Florida.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is going to happen now, Enid, from a legal point of view? Bauman's position has hardened. He's talking about paying to move it, but he says he won't sell. He won't entertain offers to sell, nor entertain offers to delay this anymore. He's going to go ahead, come what may, he says. Is that is there anything in it that legally can stand in his way from doing that?
Well, I guess we haven't really figured out, although we are trying to see if there are other angles that we can take. Personally, and I guess I would consider myself to be a person I would consider myself to be a spiritual person.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that we have to continue to pray, for one thing, and that this has gotten beyond all of us. Nobody seems to know just what to do. And I know we talked about, I believe her name is Jeta, and I went to a vigil last night as she performed some of the Indian rituals at Brickell Park.
Jeta is a Mayan priestess who has been conducting ceremonies on the site almost every day for a week.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or close to the site, as close as the fence will permit.
Uh-huh.
And last night there was another candlelight vigil. They're now regularly held 1 week apart, Tuesday night, starting at 5:30.
Okay.
And Jeta held a marvelous, she has an incredible voice, and in fact, Art, we're hoping to have her on the show on Friday night, to lead the nation in a ceremony to appeal to Mr. Bauman's better instincts and his higher sense of who we all are. Because somehow I feel this situation is not beyond salvage at all. I'm frankly more optimistic tonight than I've been for the last 3 weeks that I've been here.
Based on what?
Based on a sense of people on the ground. Enid is only one of all kinds of people who've come together and who are really cooperating in an effort, political, cultural, spiritual, financial, to make a miracle happen. And I've come to believe that this is almost like a symbolic moment where people, as I said a couple nights ago, decide enough is enough and we do something different. And the more we learn scientifically, Bob Carr gave a very brilliant presentation this afternoon where he laid out some things that I didn't know about what they had discovered and how far back this goes. And the
I've been reading about Bob Carr, by the way, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that, that he was actually due to retire a few, two or three weeks ago.
That's right.
But that this has sort of held him there, and Bob Carr is the archaeologist there, right?
He is the chief archaeologist. He's part of the preservation group appointed by the county. He has a very tiny staff.
All right, what is Bob Carr's main argument now? I mean, what's he saying about the circle?
Well, he is believing that it's at least 2,000 years old.
Oh, boy.
And that it could be much older. He acknowledged tonight that it could be much older. He showed close-ups of the basins. He showed how they have a remarkable pattern that they are recurring around the circle. In other words, there appears to be certain geometry to the basins in certain parts of the circle that are duplicated on the opposite side of the circle. So whoever did this was a very sophisticated cartographic and engineering expert or experts. Mm-hmm. And the minimum, I mean, he affirmed everything I said the other night about this being at the mouth of a delta where the river, you know, and hurricanes tend to destroy the ground cover, so that what you basically have is a stripped area that has new stuff that comes down, and by new we mean 2,000 years. It could be much older. He acknowledges now that some of his own people are saying it could be much older, and there could be more. Everyone now admits freely that while giving lip service to preserving and investigating, Bauman has restricted Bob and his colleagues to only that 50-square-foot circle.
All right, Richard.
And it's 2 acres.
I'm a realist. I'm a pragmatist, and when I look at this and I read the stories right now, I'm glad you're optimistic, but it doesn't sound good. And so far I haven't heard one person say, well, look, there's something legal that can still stop this, because it sounds to me like you're saying there's nothing legal that can stop this anymore, except to plead with Mr. Bauman not to do it. And his position is like hard as a rock. Now, is that inaccurate?
As of tonight.
You know what? May I interrupt here?
Well, barely, because we're just about out of time. We'll come right back. Hold on, please. Is that accurate, Richard?
As of tonight.
All right. We'll be right back.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from February 10, 1999.
This really seems like good bumper music for this topic. It seems ancient. Very old. Kind of unknown. I'm Art Bell. Robert Ghostwolf, Richard C. Hoagland, and Enid Pinkney are here. Enid is the first African-American president of Dade Heritage Trust that tries to save things. Now, I realize I'm looking at this pragmatically, very hard-bitten, hard-nosed, but the way I look at it, unless a miracle occurs between now and the 26th, this thing's going to be ripped from the ground as is, best case, and moved, and then there's going to be cement there. At least that's the way I look at it this night. We'll get back to our guests in a moment. Back to my guest now, and that is the situation as I see it right now, and of course I'm always sort of a little pessimistic about things. Enid Pinkney, you were about to say something or wanted to say something at the bottom of the hour. Go ahead.
Yes, we had a volunteer meeting, I think it was last night, and there was a lady there who says that she is an empress. of the Washita Nation, an Indian.
Yes.
Or a Native American or an indigenous person. And she said that because she is from this nation, that she can file suit on behalf of her people.
Where?
Now, I'm not sure just how this is going to work out.
I'm not either.
I don't know.
Well, I do. This afternoon at the presentation that Bob Carr made at the university, a law professor, international law professor, who is a guest professor here in Miami, stood up. And he said, he announced that he has written a paper dealing with specifically this type of subject, which is Native peoples, indigenous peoples all over the world whose sacred traditions and burial sites and ceremonial centers have been trampled on and defiled by developers, not just in this country, but all over the planet.
Yes.
It is about to be published by the Harvard Law Review. I am attempting to get him to come on the show as a guest, Art, because what he said was that the United States is a signatory to an agreement through the OAS, the Organization of American States.
Right.
And that if this site is developed without federal stay and intervention on the part of the president and the State Department, the United States will be an outlaw in terms of this convention in the world.
All right, but according to the Miami Herald, when inquiries were made at the federal government, which were made, they said they had no sway at all.
That was yesterday. This is today. This is a moving target. This story is moving at warp 9, all right? Moment by moment, things change. This came out tonight. The professor is going to fax me the article tomorrow. I will take a look at it. I'll have a couple of lawyers here that I know take a look at it. The people who have been faxing the White House need to have that input to know specifically what to tell the First Lady and Al Gore, who were two targets of Alex Penelis's phone call at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Now, we don't have the results yet of the phone call from the Dade County mayor to the White House.
Okay.
We will probably find out tomorrow morning in the Miami Herald.
All right.
But we now have a legal international convention,
interesting,
which we may be in violation of if the United States government does not step in and buy the time required to do the appropriate thing.
Mm.
The other piece of news that makes me very optimistic is we now have discovered where Mr. Bauman's money is coming from.
Richard, you know, I wouldn't expect a dinner invitation to the Bauman home anytime soon here.
Okay. It turns out that the money for this project is coming from the Teamsters, from the unions.
Uh-huh.
There are a lot of union people across America tonight and beyond listening to us, who I am sure are aghast that their funds are being used to desecrate someone's sacred traditions and religion with absolutely not a whimper, not a wink, not anything but get on with the money.
Okay,
and if they were to express...
Richard, I'm not sure that's totally fair to him. I understand that...
Remember, he will not allow Native Americans to come in
and
pray.
I don't like that either.
Why is that going on?
I know, but then I'm not sure your prior statement was fully justified. In other words, he has delayed the project. He has offered at his expense.
Actually, no, Art, he has not. While he was waiting for the licenses, there was nothing else that could be done except to let Bob Carr dig in the dirt in that 50
square feet.
Sure,
sure. But he's got them now, right? He's got the license.
He has them now, but there is a certain grace period that is required before he can actually begin construction. And we don't know the timing on his funds. Remember, the funds are tied up and there are transfers and his loans begin on a certain date. That's why this 26th date is a hard and fast date. That has something to do with the funding. And that goes back to where the funding is coming from, which we now know is the Teamsters Union.
Yeah, it also says here in the article for the Herald, in addition, the county's archaeologist, Carr, said Bauman has tightly restricted the dig to a 50-square-foot area, apparently fearing that other antiquities will be found on the 2.2-acre site. God.
Well, the point of leverage I would recommend to Americans tonight is if you're a union member, you know, call up your union and tell them how you feel. Send a fax. find out how to get to the head of the Teamsters. I don't have his fax number handy, but I'm sure someone can fax it to you, Art, out in the vast Art Bell audience.
You know, it really is serious, Richard. I mean, the very least I think Mr. Bellman ought to do, if he wants to continue with a good spirit, is to allow a full evaluation of the area. I mean, surely, Mr. Bellman does not want to be known as somebody who concreted over an ancient, important site, a truly important site. And if we don't do a careful examination of the site, which he could still allow now, are you listening, Mr. Bellman, then, you know, you're just going to be forever plagued with this if you have any sort of sense of moral correctness within you, and I suspect you do, or you would not have done what you've already done, or at least I hope you do. So I would say let the site be examined, or this, you know, after it's concrete, why it's going to be one of those things that hangs over you. I wouldn't want that, would you?
I have a letter here from the University of California, Riverside, from a geophysicist at the University of Riverside, who is offering to assemble the kind of equipment to do a proper survey.
How quickly could it be done?
Well, it could be done in a matter of days.
All right.
There would be a little bit of money required that we'd have to raise, but I'm sure that we could do that easily. That's not the only effort that has been, you know, put forward. Gypsy Graves here has identified equipment.
Right. Mr. Bellman then could make a good faith move by allowing the kind of examination you're talking about. There is time remaining to do that.
Remember what I said the other night? Just as we were going off the air, that there had been a paper discovered, a scientific paper written in the Journal of the Museum of Miami, Museum of Science of Miami.
Mm-hmm.
We now have identified the article. We have found the article tonight, and it's extraordinary. It turns out it was written in 1969, referencing the housing project, the five apartments that were built on this site back in 1948.
Right.
In 1948, when workmen were creating the foundations for those apartment buildings, they found something. And this scientist, Dr. Manson Valentine, who was one of the discoverers of the Bimini Road art,
mm-hmm.
he wrote it up in the Museum Journal in 1969, in February, exactly 30 years ago this month. He described a 30-foot wide, not 9-foot as I said, but 30-foot wide vertical shaft,
mm-hmm.
that the workmen explored down to a depth of 60 feet.
Totally impossible.
Before they gave up and just covered it over and built the apartment house.
That's absolutely impossible.
This site is right at the mouth of the Miami River and the Atlantic Ocean.
And the water table is what?
The water table is 4 feet down.
4 feet down.
So if you dig 60 feet down, you've got guys, Indians, we're imagining now, digging underwater, which, of course, is insane.
Yeah.
So this is telling us that somebody dug a vertical shaft 30 feet across, almost as large as this ceremonial Stonehenge-like circle.
How, Richard? How could that have
been? Exactly. There are only two possibilities. One is extraordinary, and the other is unbelievable.
Well, all right.
The extraordinary is that the site is so old that this sacred piece of land is so ancient and so revered that it goes back to around the last ice age when the Atlantic Ocean was several hundred feet lower than it is now, and that means 13 to 14,000 years ago this complex was begun. That's the extraordinary. The unbelievable is that it was done more recently in the last several thousand years by a technology that we have only recently reinvented, meaning hydrological pumps and cofferdams and stuff like that. The fact is that Bob Carr was so excited when I called him earlier tonight and told him we had found, through Gypsy Graves' wonderful efforts, a hard copy at the museum of this vital article, which will be faxed to all interested parties tomorrow morning.
Oh, my.
That we think we now have the lever, the scientific lever, to mandate from the White House a stay on this in compliance with the OAS agreement we have signed as a nation to protect indigenous peoples. And this is going to give indigenous a whole new meaning, boys and girls, because this is getting wondrously extraordinary.
Well, there goes even tea time at the Bauman's for you.
Robert, you've been awfully quiet.
Yeah, this is some collision story.
There's all these things that we're talking about, which people have to keep sending those faxes in.
That's the only thing that's keeping this alive.
I understand. Get your paper and pencil. We'll tell you folks relevant
numbers.
Something
that we should consider.
What?
You just, you know, just today when I came back to Washington here to work with some of the elders up in here because I feel I could do more, I got news that Thomas Banyaka has passed away.
Oh.
So we are now down to a very few number of the original Hopi Sinem that are left. But you just don't go around and dig up sites like this. You don't do that kind of stuff. As Grandfather Thomas would say, it's bad medicine. And it's going to unleash things that they might not consider.
Well, I think, though, again...
I don't know if I'd want to live in that apartment building.
Yeah. I'm thinking the best thing you can do right now is appeal to Mr. Bauman's sense of moral propriety, and I'm sure he has some. And
I think the governor might appeal to that sense.
Well, what I want, who am I? I want an examination to at least really know what's there.
Not
just in the circle, but the 2.2 acre site before we proceed. Now, I would think Mr. Bauman, after he sits down and thinks about it, would allow that. I mean, what if he's destroying one of the most important sites we have in the whole country from an archaeological point of view? That's serious karma.
From a financial point of view, if that's what was discovered, you realize what he could actually potentially make if it's really that?
Yeah, I wonder if he's thought about that. Yeah, that's another good appeal. You're absolutely correct.
Let me bring up something off the wall since we're discussing pretty extraordinary things. In some of Edgar Cayce's readings, and I am involved heavily in a Fox special to air on March 2nd, which deals, among other things, with Edgar Cayce's predictions vis-a-vis Egypt.
Are you talking about... I've got a folder in front of me. It says, Opening the Lost Tombs.
Yes,
live from Egypt, it says.
That's the show. They have expanded our work to an entire segment in that show,
mm-hmm.
which we'll talk about at some other time. The point is that Cayce's readings, which are pretty interesting, refer to the emergence of Atlantis.
That's right.
In 1998. This site was discovered to be as interesting as it is in September of 1998.
Could actually have something to do with Atlantis. We don't know any of this.
But we need time to find out. Again, the faxes should go to the White House, to the governor, and to CNN, and to Mayor Pinellas. Those are the four numbers we should give out tonight. And unequivocally, sources very close to this investigation told me tonight that without the support of the audience all across the country,
yes,
this thing would have gone under the bulldozer 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, well, I sure believe that. All right, the White House phone number, the First Lady, I presume.
Directly to the First Lady.
Okay.
And make reference, if you can remember, to the OAS Convention to Preserve Sacred Sites of Indigenous Peoples, to which we are a signatory.
Okay. That would be the federal side.
That's the federal side. And I was also told by sources very close to the investigation that federal help and intervention is the only thing they can look to now to save the day.
All right. So that means lay heavily into this, folks. Now, what else have you?
Governor Jeb Bush. Bushes have been incredibly silent, even though there's a history of interest in ancient archaeology and they're going to the pyramids in December of this year for the millennium shift. Governor Jeb Bush has been very silent on this. In fact, there's been not one peep out of the governor's office.
All right.
Again, mention the international implications and how we look in the eyes of the world. I mean, we don't look very good. We really don't.
I don't feel good about this myself, and I'm sitting here in Nevada. The whole thing makes me sick.
And finally, give Mayor Pinellas a pat on the back and let him know that you're with him because he's leading the fight now politically here in Dade County.
Mayor of Miami, who's
mayor
helping?
Mayor of Dade County.
All right. Oh, Dade County, all right.
Dade County, Alex Pinellas. No, the mayor of Miami's taking a strong position on the opposite side.
I see. All right, so mayor of Dade County.
Alex Pinellas.
All right, we've got a couple of minutes left.
Heritage Trust has announced that we are establishing an account for our Save Our Circle, and contributions may be sent to Date Heritage Trust Historic Preservation Center.
Robert Ghostwolf, anything final?
I think that it should be, you know, mentioned that from what I've experienced, what's going on is not the sentiment of the people in Miami, and it's definitely not the consentment of...
Have there been surveys taken of the public's feeling on this?
I don't think there has.
Gee, somebody ought to do that, some enterprising radio
station.
But then
there's been a lot of things where suddenly doors are shut down with steel.
Well, some enterprising radio station like WINZ, for example, in Miami could do something like that and take a quick poll and find out what the people of Miami think. That'd be a good idea. Maybe even the newspaper. Who knows? Richard, any final thoughts?
I am hopeful. And I can't give you a specific other than the trend curve on the science and the trend curve on people is positive. The trend curve on law and Mr. Bauman's position is increasingly tenuous in terms of the international things I discussed. And the support of the country is overwhelming. And we unequivocally have been informed that without everyone out there tonight listening, this thing would have been history weeks ago.
All right. Then, in that case, I thank all of you, Robert Ghostwolf, Richard Hoagland, and Enid Pinckney, for what you have contributed tonight. And there is your update, folks. To me, and again, I'm the hard-bitten realist in all of this, I see no legal restraints save perhaps the international federal approach, if that is a legitimate one, I hope it is, that would stop this. That's your update. You're up to the moment now on what's going on in Miami. And remember, you have a part of that. That is your concern. I don't care where you are. It should be concern to all of us. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from February 10, 1999.
Good morning from the high desert. I'm Art Bell.
Far, we've been traveling far without a home, but not without a star. Free, only want to be free.
Oh, Neil Diamond. Where are my pictures?
Hang on to a dream.
This guy is absolutely incredible.
On the boats and on the planes, they're coming to America, never looking back again. They're coming to America. Home. Gonna see so far away. Traveling light today, in the eye of the storm, in the eye of the storm.
Well, good morning, everybody. Coming up in a moment.
To a new and a shiny place.
God, this is so good, isn't it?
Make our bed, we'll say our pray.
My very good friend, Danion Brinkley.
Freedom's light burning warm.
Ah, I could hear that whole thing. Just absolutely incredible. All right. This is going to be very interesting. He's a good friend of mine. And he is the most famous dead guy in the modern world. In the modern world. I'll add that little caveat. He is Danion Brinkley. He wrote Saved by the Light, At Peace in the Light. He leads a group called Compassion in Action. And he's a very interesting individual. Here is Danion Brinkley. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Art.
Hi.
Hi, America.
Okay, Dan, lots of work to do, lots of areas to talk about tonight. And you notice I introduced you as the most famous dead guy in the modern world. And the reason I did that is because it's a logical follow-up on last night's program. Hal Lindsey was here.
Okay.
Very articulate, very educated, very fundamental, very much Christian. And since you probably are the most famous NDE experiencer, your name came up a number of times during the program regarding NDEs. And I related various aspects of your NDEs to him. And we had a discussion about prophecy and NDEs in general. And he said, with respect to NDEs, more specifically the positive ones, I thought that was interesting, that he regarded them as probably not genuine, that while they were interesting and he listened to people who told stories like yours, he thought it entirely possible the information derived during that NDE was bogus, you know, from an evil source even. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think everyone has a right to have their opinion. But after you have two or three of them, it'll tend to change. It's like a Mark Twain said, you know more about a cat when you have it by the tail than watching it from across the street. And so,
did he say that?
Yeah.
That's a good quote.
And so when I start to listen, you know, Art, I've been here 23 years. I've been through three of these experiences, lightning, open heart surgery, and brain surgery, and
okay,
really critical situations.
There is, let's define the difference between what you went through. Now, you went through three, I know you did, near-death experiences.
Yeah, one death experience and
one
near-death.
Or two near-death, all right. So a total of three, one death experience. Now, that's what we were talking about last night. Hal Lindsey said there's only one person who has ever come back from the dead.
I beg to differ with him.
Of course, is Jesus Christ. Now,
Now,
in your case, let's get down to it. You were struck by lightning. You were out for
28 minutes.
Now, that means no respiration, no heartbeat, no brain waves.
Covered with a sheet.
Nada. Covered with a sheet, dead.
Mm-hmm.
20 minutes.
28 minutes. I'm sorry,
28 minutes. Now, yep. I've got to say, you know, 28 minutes just about crosses the line.
And
I'm no physician, but it seems to me after 28 minutes, you are dead. You're dead. Now,
but Art, they're resuscitating people up longer than that usually, but it's hypothermia or certain forms of heart attacks.
Right. Not at room temperature, as Rush would say. And so you're as close to dead, having been dead, if not dead, than anybody I have ever talked to.
Well, I mean, I came back. I mean, I went through this experience when I was struck by lightning. And I was 28 minutes completely paralyzed for 6 days, partially paralyzed for 7 months, 2 years to learn to walk and feed myself, and lost about 50 pounds in the course of that. And, you know, the struggle along with each day, and sometimes when you're electrocuted, it has a tendency to sometimes alter your perspective on things.
Mm-hmm.
And after going through this, the first time I knew absolutely that there is a way at which we leave this world. I don't know everything about heaven, and I don't know everything about all what happens afterwards, you know. But when I went the first time, it was when I was dead. The next two times, open-heart surgery, you know, your heart stops, and they have to put you on artificial life support. And I had a second one. And then when they did brain surgery, I had a third one.
Yeah, I was there for that
one. Yeah,
and
you were there. So, you know, look at where I was in that hospital and look at what I was going through. And then I appreciate Mr. Lindsay's point of perspective, you know, because it's hard to believe. And if you have a mindset that's rooted a lot in the traditions of dogma of religion, it's hard. I mean, I come from the Deep South. You know, everybody goes to hell down there, and everybody has a perspective about that in the fundamentalist point of view. But when you have one, then what you're talking about changes.
Well, now, there was one thing I'd like to note here, and that is when we talked, I had, God, Dan, it was the most incredible description I've ever heard of a negative NDE given by this young lady. It took about an hour and a half, 2 hours to unfold, and it's the most vivid, impressive, shocking, amazing story you've ever heard in your whole life. This young lady went to places where there were hell, where there was absolutely hell, there's no question about it, and then places where there was not hell, where there was a light being of some sort. But it was fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And he said, Hal Lindsey said, of those negative experiences, that he believed them.
So the positive message that the Christ brought back from the dead, that he could raise himself from the dead to show us that there was a life after death and that there are many mansions in my Father's house, which is the definition of the crystal cities. Now, he can't believe that one based on the theory of looking at what we're saying, mm-hmm. but the fact that there is a place that establishes hell is a criterion that he is using to give validity to his own particular perspective on what is good and bad and what is the afterlife. Well, I always look at it like this.
Yeah, that's rigid dogma, that's for sure.
I mean, listen to what he's saying. It's totally opposite. If I came back and told the same thing that the Christ had said, it would, in his eyes, be wrong.
I could tell you only what he would say if he was here. He would say, read the Bible if you want to know. Read the Bible. If you want to know about prophecy, read the Bible. That's what he'd say. And with respect to if you want to know what happens after you die, read the Bible. In other words, it's very, very rigid, standard Christian fundamentalist dogma.
Well, and it's also fear-based. Listen to what I'm hearing. I'm hearing fear-based. As to prophecies...
Yeah, I brought that up to him, too, by the way.
Yeah, I never, you know, Art, I never intended to become the prophet. I never intended to become what I'm really known for. I mean, I'm known a lot about what the predictions were in the book. All I did was describe what I saw and what happened when I was over there in the Crystal City. And so much of the stuff, you know, some of them are so accurate and so precise that it just is the way we're going. But it all leads to a time around 2009, 10, 11, and 12 that a whole new emergence of how we see and know and understand the world will have changed by then. And so the fact that just like you can, when we were talking earlier, box 4 and 5 literally describes the Oslo Accord and the Wye River Peace Accord, the disappearance of Jordan, and all the things. You know, Jordan is Palestine, and until World War One, it was Palestine.
That's right.
And when they collapsed the old Ottoman Empire, the British created Jordan as a nation. It's been Palestine for 5,000 years. It's only been Jordan for about 80.
But what I think Hal Lindsey was saying, was that real as they seemed to you, and he didn't doubt that you went to a place and saw things, he simply was suggesting that from his point of view, you were being fooled.
God, what an expert on something that he's never had.
That's a point well taken.
I believe, listen, Hal Lindsey prophesizes his interpretation of the Bible. He interprets the Bible and what it says, and then he takes a very strong stand on the fact that this is what the Bible, as he interprets, prophesies, like the book of Revelation.
Right.
Well, I can see a lot of the things from what I went through that have a lot to do with Revelations. I can see that where some of the things I hear in Revelations, and then others I didn't see it at all. But I can see how the World War, the 2 million yellow man army, and they're now building the Three Gorge Dam in China, this river that the where 200 million yellow man army could cross from one region into another region that's in Genesis. But when you look at Genesis, when you look, take a good look at, I mean, when you look at the revelation of John, not Genesis, the revelation of John, the book of Revelations, then he's doing the same thing. When I had this information, I just wrote it down and I talked about it because I was trying to understand the near-death experience.
Sure.
I never believed in any of that stuff. I had no basis. I was a Hal Lindsey-based mentality from being in the Deep South. But I had no way to understand what had happened to me. I just knew it happened to me, and I lay in a bed for almost 2 years and had a lot of time to think about it.
Now, let me stop you because I'm not so sure about that one. You were a Hal Lindsey kind of fundamentalist from the South?
Well,
don't think so.
No,
I saw your movie. You were, thing was halfway accurate, you were pretty much a non-church-going ruffian.
No, I was as mean as a, you know, as just as mean and as vicious as a person. If you ever go to my hometown, all you have to do is ask anybody. There's no way out of it. What can I say? But I think it came from rebelling against a lot of the hardcore fundamentalist type perspectives that are in the South. I mean, not that these are bad people or anything. It's just that when it's so fear-based, when nothing I experienced. See, I didn't have a hellish experience, and I always figured that if anybody would be going to hell, it would certainly be me. And in none of the three events did I experience a hellish experience.
That's a very good point. Bearing in mind who you were when this happened to you, you should have gone straight to hell without passing go nor collecting $200.
No question about it.
If anybody deserved it at that point, that would have been you.
No question.
And you know, did you hear, this is very confusing, Dan, the young lady who was on here talking about this horrible NDE she had, you know what she was doing when it happened to her? She was riding a bicycle, Dan, on her way home from church, Dan, and a car hit her from the rear and threw her 60 feet into the air, and she broke and internally hemorrhaged everything she had.
Poor baby.
I mean, she was, you know, as serious as what happened to you. And here she was, I mean, here you were the meanest bastard in town, and here she was coming back from a church social voluntary function, got whacked by a car, and went to hell. Now, let's stop and think about this for a minute.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't understand all that art. I've talked to people. I mean, I feel sorry for it, and I hope that everybody that's the art nuts, like I always do, let's take a moment and surround that lady with love and light. Every single 9 million or ever how many million of people are listed, take a moment and surround her with as much love and as much
light. It's a good idea, but where is the sense?
Around this lady so that what she experienced, we help bring her either understanding. And I'd like to know her name and number, and I'd like to talk to her.
Yeah, but next time you get to a computer, what she said is up on my website in real audio. Listen to it. But, Dan, the question is, what kind of crazy sense does this make?
Well, I mean,
give me a couple of thoughts here. Why do you, the worst, go to the best place, and why does the best go to the worst place? I'd like that one answered.
But see, there's a lot to do with the spiritual nature. That person that's riding that bicycle could be a great master. I mean, I've learned to live and accept so many things that I never would have to think before. And that because of the incident and where she went and the sense of what was going on, I don't know what the sermon was about that Sunday.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, because I've been researching near-death experiences now for 23 years, and a lot of situations that you find yourself in, and as you're describing the event, you look before, you look after, you see what's on that person's mind, because the mind is a powerful thing. I don't know what the sermon was about or what she was at the social, what was the conversations there, so there could be a trigger mechanism planted in her thought as she moved to that dimension, that she got to see and understand that place as it existed. I mean, I don't really understand a lot of that stuff because I've talked to people who had some of the scariest stuff in the world happen to them. You know, I'm always interested in those. And that's roughly 3 or 4%.
Well, that's what they say. But of course, I can tell you straight on, Dan. If I had an NDE, you know, and I was really clinically 4 feet in the air, I went to hell and I came back. I don't think I'd get up and talk about it. I don't think.
Well, a lot of people are. I agree with you. I mean, I'm the kind of person, if I went to hell, I'd come back and tell you I went to hell. You know, but a lot of people that I've talked to, they, you know, there's a side of me that understands the near-death experience, and it's them looking for answers.
Mm.
That's where I get my ratio from. I probably talked to maybe 1,500 people worldwide who had serious NDEs, and then I've heard some really hellacious experiences. But when you look at all the situations that are around and you take all those things, all those factors in, you can sometimes see a pattern about it. It could have been a lot of what the sermon was about, and she passed through those levels. The fact that she came back and how it affected and changed her life, I mean, I know that would, is the most important point to me.
She saw several entrance places, one of which she went in, which was clearly hell, another which she looked in, which was clearly hell, but did not go into, and then spent a period of time with a being of light, and then at the final moment decided herself, essentially, that she was going to come back and then did. I mean, it's a very interesting story, but I hold on, Dan, we're coming to the bottom of the hour. I really would like to understand why the apparently good, any given Sunday sermon or not, would go and have a hellish experience, and the obviously bad would go to a good place.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
Do you think that's where Daniel Wrinkley and others have gone? To the center of the mind.
Come along if you can.
Or somewhere else.
Come along if you can. Take a ride to the land inside of your mind.
We'll be right back. Here he is again. It's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Brinkley. That's what I called you. I think it was a show we did up in Alaska.
Yeah.
There's you know, people need to know that not all the old Dan is gone. Occasionally Dr. Jekyll shows up, and you still have sort of, if the cause is maybe perhaps a little different now that you're older, but you still have you're quick to anger. Quick to become less than in certain circumstances, a fully loving, converted person, hey?
Oh, absolutely. I can guarantee you that. But you see, Art, the whole key is this. When you have this experience,
mm-hmm.
and mine, I mean, I had a hellish experience in having my life review.
Yes.
But it wasn't like where this young lady described, but I have heard this exact story. I mean, I've heard this exact story literally told like that from the different levels of where a person explored. But when you have a panoramic life of you and you literally become everything, you see your whole life pass before you and then you watch it second person and then you literally become every person that you've ever encountered.
Yep.
And you have to feel the direct results of your interaction.
That's hell.
That is a hellish experience because I had created so much. You know, I was just a complete jackass.
Yep.
And I created, and I'm still a jackass, but not quite as bad because the system of judgment is, if God couldn't come today and God sent me, then in the world I'm now living in, what difference did God make?
I don't know. Now you're jackass doing a lot of good works, is what you are.
Absolutely. That's the true key. But I didn't turn into a messiah or a prophet or any of that. I had to relearn and look at religions from every aspect. I had to explore. I had to start reading people like Ruth Montgomery and books of that period, 1975, to try to understand this. That's how I got involved and interested in so many other things as I was trying to understand it.
Okay, this is moving away a little bit, but I have to ask you about this. I promised somebody back in December that I would. There's a man named Dr. Joe Cusimano. He wrote a book called Transforming Scrooge. And the premise of his book, Dan, was that Scrooge had the same thing you had.
I'd have to say that.
Now, if you think about that, remember A Christmas Carol, that in fact...
And Dickens wrote it as a...
Yeah.
I'd have to say that where he got that from, because I've heard that, but, you know, someone brought that up to me before, because I had a past, present, and future reviews.
That's correct, yes.
And I saw, and so wherever that concept came from, I don't know if we've ever looked in Dickinson's writings to find out where that concept came from, but I would very much agree with that. And I don't know why I saw the future, Art. I've worried about it, like this lady seeing levels of hell. I can remember standing in a place in the early moments after I'd had the panoramic life review, and I could see... Because I had a few moments like I was supposed to forgive myself. And I couldn't bring myself for some things I had done. I couldn't forgive myself for them. And I think that had a lot to do why I had to go back with an open heart surgery in 1989. And then why in 1997, because of the mental place, you know, then next was my brain. Electrocution is spiritual. That's an act of God. The only thing that is in a legal court that you can sue someone and they can use an act of God as the defense in a legal and stand and use an act of God in a federal court as their defense. So I think it's pretty interesting that my spiritual self and then my heart and then my mind, each one is affected, parts taken away and those kinds of things, looking at spirituality. But I don't know why. I believe that the things that I saw that were future events, like, you know, Chernobyl and the Desert Storm and the advances in medical technology using natural ways again and the light healing machines.
All of these things are true, and they were documented when?
Oh, 1975 and 76.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing new about what I talk about. They're all the same things. But at a place right after, before I went to the Crystal Cities, and before I received this information, after I had the life review, there was a place in there to forgive myself. I couldn't do it. At that time, they were always around me. I became aware of two things. And, you know, I used to put this in the lecture all the time, but I could see beings below me. And they were like me. They were still spiritual light beings because I was a being built of light. And as I would see them, they were moving, and I would focus on them. The level became so slow. You know, it was horrifyingly painful, but the fact of the resonance that was so slow that I could not bear it or stand it. And then above me, to my left, I could see beings that looked like me, and when I focused on them, it was like drinking 25 cups of coffee. The frequency was so high and so more pure than the level of where I was then, I couldn't stay there.
Have you seen Robin Williams' What Dreams May Come Yet?
Oh, yes.
All right. Both in that movie, which was astounding, I thought.
Oh, it's magnificent.
And in the story that young lady told the other morning, Dan, maybe it's true that that people die and they, in effect, judge themselves and, in effect, condemn themselves to hell. In other words, they cannot forgive themselves. And so they
accept that.
They place themselves in that horrible place, and they keep themselves there.
See, I know that's possible. After, when you passed into the Crystal City, when I began to move toward these cities, like seeing Denver from the desert, you know, we were like going into Denver, there were beautiful cities and they were lighted. They were like built of glass. As I moved into these places and I began to expand outward before I had the visions, I was really aware that there were multi-levels and multi-dimensions, and that I could live in simultaneous thought patterns and places.
Yes.
I mean, it was amazing, Art, the expansive power of being a spiritual being again. I could sense anything I wanted to sense. I had just seen enough of bad things. I guess if that was what I was after, I would have seen more. I mean, after my panoramic life review. But when I moved into the Crystal Cities and I lived in these events, these boxes were, I was back in a world of, like, this reality, the physical reality, and I was actually there.
It's kind of like Scrooge, isn't it, really? I mean,
yeah.
you were sent into the past, into the present, into the future. You got to actually look at what would occur. You came back. You documented it. Nobody can argue about that.
No,
you did it. There's another thing that nobody can argue about, and that I can attest to, not very frequently when I have a guest on, am I able to say I know something for sure. But there is one thing I know for sure about Dan Brinkley, and that is that you do have, at times, in my opinion, worrisome psychic power that I've seen demonstrated again and again and again. No one needs to tell me it's true. It's true. It came from somewhere. And it sure didn't come from your youth. It occurred and began when you were electrocuted. There's just no question about it. I know that's true.
Oh, Art. I mean, you know, I was on a show the other night, and I described a guy. I mean, I can live in those realms, Art. Because when you get electrocuted, it and your electrical chemical, it enhances certain things.
Something happens.
Sure. Yeah. And there was a whole new medical paradigm called chiromedicine that the National Institute for Health of Offices of Rare Diseases and Disorders has established the fact that people who are struck by lightning act totally different in their makeup and their nature of people who are electrocuted or, you know, like hit the power pole or things like that.
Sure.
And I've always wondered how this operates. I mean, I can literally communicate with people from the other side. I have this happen to me a lot when I'm around someone and they're talking to me and I go into like a little trance-like place. Mm-hmm. And then I'm able to communicate. Last night, what I use this talent for is helping people resolve their issues. Last night, I was with a veteran, Richard, and he was on his way, you know, he was making his transition.
You mean he was dying?
Yeah. And I was sitting there with him, and I went to assess the case because I do volunteer work like everybody I ask in Compassion Action to do, and I don't just talk this, I live this.
I know every day you're with the dying, and I don't know how you do that.
Well, I mean, I'm like so comfortable with the process, Art, and I'm literally the person. I know. Last night with this guy, he was almost coma, but I could go and enter his consciousness and see what is holding him as he was struggling this prostate cancer that's completely wiped him out, and what was holding him. And the two other people with me from Compassion in Action, I told them what I perceived when his cousin and her husband got there. Mm-hmm. I asked them about the guy. I even had his name, and I asked them if this had occurred in their family relationship, mm-hmm. and if this was happening, and they verified it to the letter, everything that I had said.
Yep.
And my two people looked at me, but it was me trying to help him.
No, I know. I've seen you do it. I've seen you do it too many times.
I
gives me the heebie-jeebies.
Remember when we read that letter? You had that letter on your desk.
Yes, of course.
I picked it up to hand to you, and I read what the letter said.
Yep.
even who drove it over there and what kind of car they were driving.
I know.
That was so funny.
I know. I've seen that and too many other things. So I know it's true. I mean, I know you have this gift.
Well, I wonder what old Hal would say about that. You should ask him about that. Not only did I bring back things that are now the present and into the future,
mm-hmm.
but I also brought back one of the gifts of the spirit.
Well, I can tell you what he might say. He might say, Danyon, where do you derive this power from? Okay, it's real. Where do you derive this power from? And if your answer wasn't what he expected, then you'd get a different kind of reaction altogether that you wouldn't like.
Oh, no, I'd like anything he says. You see, because, you know what, Art, when people talk about how, like, what Hal does, and I like some of Hal Lindsey's stuff, I think he's trying to alert people to open up their spiritual consciousness. I just can't stand fear-based crap. I mean, in his book, The Messiah.
But wait a minute now. Wait a minute. There is some legitimate fear base. I mean,
no.
even, well, I know you say that, but people have had negative NDEs. Now, to me, that's fear base, real negative NDEs, where they see people in a horrible hell. Now, that serves me up a little bit of fear. I don't know about you.
But, Art, this lady was able to look and choose for herself. Look at the basis of it. I know that those realms can exist because you have the potential to create those realms whenever you choose. And when you get on the other side, what will be amazing is how much you have to learn to slow down. If I would have stayed longer, they had something they wanted me to come back and do. The seven centers, the eight rooms and the centers, and to create a level of consciousness to bridge those two worlds where people can go through the process of visiting with their relatives and have certain aspects of the near-death experience and out-of-the-body experiences. I mean, when I do this, when I'm home, as I develop these programs, just for what they sent me back to do, what it says in Saved and at Peace, I'm almost there. 23 years ago from what my father can, you know, my father's a very wonderful, wonderful person.
I know your dad.
But he's very conservative. But, you know, my dad has heard this stuff now for 23 years. He watches me be so close to completing a system of eight rooms combined in the program, like it says in Saved, that allows people to be able to move between these two worlds. That death will become something where we won't even think about it. You will be able to move through and see how the transition works and also create a nature of healing the stress that's caused by the fear. This is a lady, and my heart goes out to her. I've seen people have these kinds of experiences that terrify them. But
well, if that isn't fear-based, then what is? I mean, there is the fear of the negative.
Explored a realm in her spiritual consciousness, in herself, as this happened to her. She could have been able to explore and see things, and I'd like to hear her descriptions of what hell.
Oh, I think
like.
You really need to hear.
Oh,
that.
I'm going to listen to it as soon as we're done.
Now, she also described a period of time where she came to a white light and spent a period of time with it, in which there was incredible peace, and she said so much so, and she remained for a long time, but she finally tired of it and left there and went back by these other places she had seen and then came back to her body. That's a quick summation of what she said over a couple of hours,
wonderful.
But it was just absolutely wonderfully detailed.
That's wonderful.
But it does serve up a little bit on the fear side. It's just that it doesn't make any sense to me, Dan.
She's a good person,
gets whacked on a bicycle, she goes to a hellish place mostly. You're a bad person. You get struck by lightning, which is sort of like a sign from God anyway.
No doubt in my mind.
Here you go, boy.
And I know I didn't go to the center of my mind because it's mostly empty.
Well, I was going to bring that up. Now, that really goes to the core of what we're talking about here. Did Danyon Brinkley, closer to death, real death as we know it, than anybody I know, really leave his body and go elsewhere, or did he take a journey to the center of some sort of dying mind?
Oh, I can tell you absolutely not. I went, and you know, why I can say absolutely is I've had three of them. I've talked to people who've been resuscitated, and I've been around death for 23 years. I'm literally at it every day.
Every day, I know.
When you live in I put in 17 hours in dealing with these issues in the last 2 days.
I know, several have died.
And when you live in it, and you talk to people, and the comfort zone that they have with you because you're there with them, and they've been resuscitated, and a lot of people I don't tell my story unless I can help someone with it. And
when you're with someone who's dying, Dan, I asked you this earlier privately on the phone, and I'll ask you again publicly. I know the comfort you give the dying. You spend time with dying vets, sometimes several a day. People don't know that. It must be intensely difficult, draining work to do to be with several people who are dying every day. And you tell them what lies on the other side as you know it. Are there ever times, Dan, when you're not sure you're telling them the truth? Or where you even have the slightest doubt, where in your mind you might imagine you're telling them something good and comforting, but it might not be the truth? That where
all
you wonder art, about it yourself.
To see art, remember, there's that Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Danyon side of me, too.
Yep.
I tell people exactly what I think they are looking for, but I would not tell them if I didn't know this for sure, and I hadn't gone through it three times and know this. And remember, the first time I had no preparation, no idea. But the next two times, I had days to prepare, to think, to look at it, to study it, if I was going to have one, if I was even going to survive.
Yeah.
See, because the second time, I wouldn't even, when I was going to have open-heart surgery, Art, I wouldn't even allow sign the papers for them to do the surgery. I was going because I felt so bad in the chest pains and the kind of things that were happening to me. And what lightning does to you, and I'm still, where I am with the problems that I have.
I do.
I had to make the choice of having open heart surgery or die within a matter of 3 hours. I took the 3 hours. Now, I knew after 14 years where this wondrous place was. And when I went back, I went through the same system, and I went to another place, another area and arena that I learned more information about the stuff I was doing and what I was to work on and how I was supposed to do it. The third time, which is the most natural or normal near-death experience, if you can call them that. But I learned about dimensional personalities and the multifacets of what it takes to be this physical being. We're spiritual, mental, emotional, ethereal, and physical, all at the same time, and each of those are different worlds. And
well, with respect to what you tell dying veterans, there is also this. Just in case you are wrong, I guess it doesn't matter. You still feel like you're doing the right thing for them at the right time. Is that correct?
I know I'm doing the right thing for them, but I don't tell them all the same stuff, Art.
All right, Dan, hold on. We're at a break point. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from February 10, 1999.
In the modern world, the most famous dead guy around, Danyon Brinkley. He's a very, very special person, folks. He's so intense, he is so psychic, that when you're with him personally, to be honest, you can only be with him so long. That's the truth. It's an interesting problem to have. Psychic people make you nervous. It's like you're dead and they're looking through you and they know everything about you. It's unsettling. Hey, Dan, what happens to a lawyer when you give him Viagra?
I don't know.
He gets taller. I told that one to my lawyer earlier today.
That's funny.
This long silence on the phone. And he told me one. Anyway, listen, back to serious stuff here. I said when I was coming in a little while ago, I was coming into this hour, I said, it's hard to be around you for extended periods of time. And I think it's hard for you to be around people for extended periods
of
time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have a, you know, Art, there's a lot of things about the spiritual nature of ourselves, and especially the intuitive part about it. I pick up so much about people, and you know, I am intense, but
I know.
Because look what runs through me. You know, when you get literally electrocuted, and I guess I've had that kind of intensity, but I am so much aware and cognizant of things going on. Like,
yeah, but it's completely unsettling. It's like having Spock next to you doing a mind meld.
Well, I do it all the time to everybody.
I know
that. I don't tell them.
Have you learned?
You've gone and blown my cover.
Have you learned to keep a lot of it to yourself?
Yeah, I don't tell people everything. I try to tell people the things that I think will help them grow in their spiritual way, and to try to give that kind of advice. I pick up so much about people.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I touch someone, literally I live in their life at that moment. Well, I don't drive so much. You know, I drive sometimes, but I can pass somebody on the road or sit at a stoplight and look at them.
I know.
And I'm living in their life where I'm seeing these things about them. And, you know, it's pretty unsettling, but I've taken 23 years to try to learn how to handle it, to look at where it comes from, try to help people develop their own kind of intuitiveness so you can be more trusting in the world that you live in and what you're hearing.
Well, you play the hand you're dealt, but boy, I'll tell you, this is some hand you've been dealt.
Well, you know, people always ask, why do I think I got chosen? Because look at where I am. But I always figured that they had to be desperate, scraping the bottom of the barrel. And they picked me to do this. But what? I mean, you know, people say, Daniel, why do you
somehow
think...
Somehow you don't think of God as scraping the bottom of the barrel up.
Well, if God picked me, you know, they'd just probably run completely out of messiahs. You know, they didn't have anything to do that day. And I know what they figured out. They said, look, let's find us a jackass and see how he handles all this stuff.
Maybe God's army is like the real army, you know, and when times get really rough... They lower their standards.
Well, I agree. You don't hear me arguing about it, but as long as we're on that Army subject, I wanted everybody out there to know it's National Salute to Hospice Veterans from the 14th to the 20th.
That it is.
And I would highly recommend that people go to a VA and visit with veterans. I'm there all the time, and I see a lot of places that these guys could use someone just to come to see them. And
yep.
You know, the new hospice stamp just came out. They just released a hospice recognition stamp. And
the post office?
Yeah, the post office. And I'd like, everybody should send a Valentine's to a vet, and they can call, you know, 1-800-827-1000 at the VA to find a local VA or local...
Give me that number again. 1-800...
1-800-827-1000.
And you would be calling to find out what your local...
Where your local one is, or www.va.gov. And they can find out where your local hospital...
So you've got a big drive going, and all you're asking people to do is send a Valentine to a vet.
That's all I'm asking. And if they can, to go by and see them. And it's, you know, if the program is Salute to Our Hospitalized Veterans. And I want everybody to never use any other stamp in the world except hospice recognition stamps, so that every piece of mail you send out, you make a statement about the quality of what hospice care is. And I want to try to improve the world's perspective, because hospice is a great organization, and it's about helping you deal with the loss and helping someone who is terminal be able to be home and be able to have the gentleness and the kindness of their families and to resolve the issues that are in between them, because I see so much of that stuff.
All right, Dan, I'm going to read this to you, and this is going to give you a chance. It's not generic. It's specific, but it's really generic, so I'm going to read it for all the people that are in this situation, and that's a lot of us these days, Dan. This is from Melissa in Las Vegas, and she simply writes, Dear Art, in 2 weeks, I'm going to go visit my mother-in-law, who's dying of brain cancer. Please ask Danyon what I should say or not say, for that matter. It will be our last time to see her before she dies. In essence, what do you say to a person who's dying? So on behalf of everybody who's about to face that, Dan.
You tell them how much you love them. And you talk about some of the, you pick out the best experiences when you laughed, when you did something together. The key to a person in transition, Art, is that the panoramic life review begins to be the early art form. The very moment a person finds that when you have the panoramic life review on the other side, anything we do on this side that helps that begin, then the person sees dignity, value, and purpose in their life. And to be there, the fact that you're there is wondrous.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing is you tell them the funny things that they about what happened in your life or the things that they've done so that the value of that person's life in the pain, the anguish, and brain cancer is really horrible, and it is so painful.
Mm-hmm.
And she's probably heavily sedated, and especially with what brain, because I know the pressure of what happens in your brain. But mostly to touch them, to hold her hand, and to talk about how much fun, how good they were, and the things that the most joyous moments in your life that you could remember being with that person. And to be comfortable in knowing they'll just lift out of that body, and they'll move down that tunnel, and they'll come to a place of love and beautiful light. And if they have their panoramic life review, the last thing they're going to see, if she's that close, is you having that, her and you having that conversation together. And when you realize that, she's going to feel the love that you're sending to her and the joy that you had, not the sorrow, because she's going home and she's going back to where she came from. And this is the key to it, because when a person can help find that point of their life of its value, and it comes from someone who loves them and they're comfortable in that place, then the transition to the other side is much simpler. Now, I would also take something that's her favorite fragrance. I like lavenders and frankincense and aromatherapy things. I always use aromatherapy. And I would play music. Some of the stuff you have is really, really great for it. And you take music. You turn the damn television off. You sit and breathe and be comfortable and surround that person with your love. You put a fragrance there that's a calming fragrance, like an aromatherapy, or an alert, whatever you think they might need.
Mm-hmm.
And then you play a little music, and you put music in the background of your conversations because you have ethereal bodies. You know, you have these auric bodies, and their vibrations and their resonance, and they're built of music or color or light. And to affect those bodies helps that person in transition. You know, Twilight Brigade, this compassion in action, which is the foundation, we train. I mean, it's just Twilight Brigade, www.twilightbrigade.com. And we train people as volunteer hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's going to be a hospice volunteer. You know, when you look at where we all are as baby boomers, the 81 million of us in this country, we're losing our moms and dads. And you have an 81% chance that a relative is going to turn to you before they turn to a doctor or turn to clergy.
Dan, there's something here. You'd like everybody to go out and be a hospice volunteer.
Absolutely. I would beg
Dan,
you.
Dan, I couldn't do it.
Oh, yes, you can.
No, I couldn't. No, I couldn't, Dan, because I don't believe I'm being, you know, this is a night for me to be just straight out with you because we're such good friends,
yeah,
even here on the air. I don't believe with the concrete belief system that you have, because you've been there and I haven't, that I don't even know for sure, Dan. I suspect there's an afterlife, but I don't know it for sure. And I couldn't sit down next to somebody who's dying and lie to them.
Well, I don't see when you talk about...
And I'm not saying you're lying. I'm saying I couldn't say it with the kind of conviction that you would need to say it to a person who's dying with. I couldn't do it.
But the loneliness that person is usually experiencing, especially with veterans, they don't give a crap what you're saying to them as long as you're there. I mean, that the person is there gives dignity to their life, and that they're willing to sit there hours on end.
I know, but you're removing the fear of death by telling them that their existence is not going to end.
But, Art, I'm also empowering...
That's important.
I'm also empowering the person who sits there and watches the peaceful transition from this world to the next, or wherever they go. Because once a person experiences this, there are so many things that are in our minds that cause us to be afraid. And a lot of it is fear-based, and it's based around death and the unknowing. But when you go through it and you're with someone and you watch that, sometimes the most beautiful things can happen. I mean, the most beautiful things. I'm very selfish is why I do hospice work, because I love to be in the place where someone is about to make that journey. But if you can go and come with training, and we go with buddy systems. We don't just throw you out there. And we have a buddy system where you go with someone and you watch the art of helping people in transition if they don't go anywhere. And when you, when
but
you
how
see
do you,
the beauty
but Dan,
of it.
But Dan, how do you really help them without really believing the things that you believe? Now, I understand how you can go in and do it. I don't understand how I could.
Or maybe they just want to tell somebody their life. A lot of times, I never tell them. I don't tell everybody, hi, I'm Daniel, I've been dead. This is what's going to happen. Get ready. I mean, people have different beliefs and their own belief systems. I pick and choose the people who ask the questions. But most of the time, I listen. I want to know the great moments in their life. I want them to tell me there's like the little big man with the Dustin Hoffman, the, and like that movie about Billy the Kid that had Emilio Estevez in it. I mean, I want to hear your life story. And I don't want to, if you're a Christian or you're Jewish or you're Islamic, I'm not going to try in the final days of your life to try to change any of that. Or, and I train my people that way. You don't do that. To be there so a person has a place to look, that you're a volunteer. Nobody's paying you that to be there.
Again,
Hal
Lindsey.
Dignity to their life.
Hal Lindsey last night. I just want to touch on what you just mentioned. Hal Lindsey last night and I talked about that. And actually, you know, Christians in the world are a minority.
Oh, yeah, 2%.
But...
other than Catholicism now, Christians in the Protestant... In the Protestant position now, but see, remember, Catholics are Christian. There's a billion.
Sure. But sure. But, Dan, Hal Lindsey would say that you would best spend your time, your final time with somebody like this, telling them the only way to God, which is Jesus. And I don't think I'm misquoting Hal Lindsey. He would say that would be your best spent time, getting them in whatever final moments they might have to come to Jesus. Now,
let me tell you something, Art. This is somebody who doesn't do hospice work. I mean, this is somebody who doesn't do hospice work. You can, you know, this is an expert in something that he doesn't do. And I was with my 169th person last night.
But one path may get, two paths may get to the same place, Dan.
Well, I think there are more ways to find what you're after. I believe in the Christian concept, and I believe that knowing the Christ is a consciousness, do unto others you'd have others do unto you, love thy neighbor as thyself.
Yep.
Because when
they're
you
obvious.
Have a panoramic life review, you literally become everybody. And when you say love thy neighbor as thyself, you're really going to do that anyway.
Mm-hmm. Who was Jesus, Dan?
Huh?
Who was Jesus?
Well, Jesus was a man, was a guy in from Judea whose name was Yahushua ben Joseph. He didn't become Jesus until around 312 when the Bible was translated from Hebrew into Greek. So the real name is Yahushua ben Joseph.
Yes.
And a lot of the things that are around his life, because I've been to the Middle East, I had to go look at all that stuff again. In this world, great masters come. People who are of the archetypes in spirituality.
Yes.
And they come to change belief systems. And the one damnable, jealous, hateful God that we had in Yahweh and sometimes in the perspectives of the Middle Eastern concepts, there had to become a change. And this master came. And I think Yahushua ben Joseph and the Christ are one is a man and the other was a person that had anointed through an experience of traveling to mystical schools and learning to be able to be a great teacher. I think there are many great masters. I don't think, to me, that the Christ is the single only point, because when someone tells me, like, you know, when you go all over the world, I've been in 81 countries, and I've seen a mountain man in Laos who, with his little tribe, and him be the finest, most wonderful father, protective energy in the tribal elders. And I've seen him. He's never heard of Christ, never heard of Jesus.
Right.
But he lives in the Christ consciousness, and
right.
he takes care of his people, and he handles this. And for someone to tell me that that person is going to hell, that's just ridiculous.
I feel the same way about that, Ben. I feel the same way. But the bottom line is, just so that I'm straight and everybody's straight here, you believe Jesus was a real man who walked upon the earth?
Who Hashua ben Hose?
Who was a grandmaster, but one of many, and not necessarily, as described, the precise son of our Creator God.
Well, not in the true context that's being pushed so adamantly by the Protestant and Reform movements. No.
Not in the most literal sense, as delivered by mainstream
dogma. No, I don't believe
dogma.
That.
All right, I've got it. Thank you. All right, Daniel Brinkley is here. I'm here. We'll take calls pretty soon. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from February 10th, 1999. Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from February 10th, 1999.
Now, I wonder if it's true that we all live as long as we're ghosts that you can see, even though we're gone. Is that the way it works?
I walk away like a movie star who gets burned in a three-way script. Into number two.
But Daniel, we can and will in a moment. With regard to the Miami Circle, just before we go back to Dan, we may even ask him about that because we're about to talk about Egypt. I just got a message, an email message, from somebody who wrote to the First Lady, Hillary Rodham Clinton, about the Miami Circle, and the last paragraph does not indeed seem like a form response. She writes, "All of us at the White House are excited about the progress made with this historic project, and we look forward to future developments. Your continued interest and participation are very important to us." Isn't that interesting? That does seem like a response, indeed, from the First Lady on this particular issue. We'll have to kind of follow that. I think it's a good transition. Daniel, welcome back. Let's talk a little bit. There are some incredible, incredible things happening in Egypt. And I guess in order, first of all, let's take them in order. There's going to be, coming up pretty soon, an opening of a tomb in Egypt, opening lost tombs live from Egypt, brought to you on Fox, I think.
Yeah.
You know about that?
Sure, I'm right in the thick of it. You know, Art, when you and I came together with the Bas Nadim and Visions Travel, and we saw the wars that were going on between all the people, we came together and brought them together.
Yep.
And I believe that what is a direct result of our efforts is the fact that they are now going live on March the 2nd with Fox, and they're going to open tombs, things that have been sealed for 4,000 years, and to open up these tombs and to open up chambers that heretofore no one's ever even described. Most of them said it didn't exist.
All right,
because the ability to be opened and the openness that's been discovered because of the work we've done. I mean, you talk to the people and you narrate with a...
What are these chambers? What are they going to...
They have a new... they're going to open a chamber. They're going to open up the door that the member of the German with the robot who went into the air shaft, and they found the door, and they're going to open this up. They're opening up to let people look and see more stuff than ever. And I think it was because of the great debate that we had last year that you were the moderator on, and people respect your opinions and what you see because you're very, very open-minded, but you're very good at looking at those situations. And I think that this great debate that's going to be in Egypt on March the 8th, I mean, I know I'm going to be there, because it'll decide and help put input into what all these issues are. See, Art, I believe just like this place in Miami, these sites and what Robert said, there are these mystical sites. They weren't just chosen because they were at the mouth of a river.
No, I believe
it wasn't just chosen because it was some plateau in Giza.
No.
These things are ancient.
No, I know.
And to be able to be a part, you know, you and I talked when I was visiting you, to be able to be a part of the unfoldment of mysteries that literally will change the whole anthropological way that we look at ourselves, our heritage, our history, our religions, our traditions. And to watch what happens in this next, between now and the year 2001, and much of the stuff I talk about in the predictions are things that I see that can be affected. I would not miss this debate.
That's coming in March, Dan. We'll talk about that in this
May.
May, all right. I'm sorry,
the
May.
TV
that's
show,
right, May.
The TV show's March 2nd on Fox, so
yep.
People can watch live what's happening there.
Okay, but that's this March, right?
Yeah, March 2nd.
March, all right. Look, I know that you know the inside story at Giza, and I know that you're tight with Zahi.
Well,
when they open those things up, what are they going to find, Dan?
Well, there some who knows. In one of them, they have no idea. The one that was immersed underwater for literally 1,000 years, and it was a myth for 2,700 years. There was nothing there. But I think as they finish draining this, what's going to be discovered is the possibility of an interconnecting chambers that what Herodotus spoke about. And this one that's been there forever, who knows? But I know there'll be something there that begins to, that's been closed for 4,000 years, and they know it's still sealed.
Mm-hmm.
And what they discover in there will probably be a lot of archaeological aspects that more than likely reinforce what the conventional archaeologists say and Egyptologists say. But you know, Art, when I sit back and look where, in my 20 years of looking at Giza and roaming the Middle East, the fact that they now say there's another chamber in the pyramid, and
that's
it's
right.
In the Great Pyramid, and they're starting to open up and let people start to look and see, and there'll be more and more discoveries because of the openness that came about through what we've done.
All right, we'll come back to that because all the same people are involved with this great debate that's going on, and we'll go through who's going to be there,
okay,
and whether we're going to be there. I guess you've already settled it in your mind. You're going to be there.
I pretty much want to try to do this, Art,
I know.
I want you to do it too.
I haven't made up my mind yet.
No.
All right, listen, December 31st of this year, Dr. Hawass and others are going to replace the gold capstone on the Great Pyramid.
Absolutely.
At midnight on December 31st, 1999. Now, that's a pretty serious thing.
Art.
What do you think will happen?
I think that the ancient world will come back alive. I think that as that energy begins to operate, and I believe that the pyramids were machines. When you study Egyptology and you look at the afterlife.
Machines.
If you walked up on a priest that... I can't go with the Egyptians' idea that they were just megalomaniacs trying to build a bigger shaped object than...
That's what Zahi would tell you.
Well, sure, but, you know, I'm around them all the time.
So you think they're machines. What do you think they are, Dan? Machines
machines that focus energy. They can take certain levels of energy built... Look at the pyramid. The pyramid at Cheops, 2,400,000 stones, some weighing up to 200 tons.
I know.
It weighs 5,955,000 tons. And it's a machine set at a certain precise, dealing with certain planetary aspects and influences. And when they put that capstone on it, that machine will start to operate again.
And what do you believe will occur?
I believe that the level of consciousness... Well, that level of consciousness using the energy, which I think is a type of scalar energy, will literally begin to raise the consciousness, especially on the plateau, but everywhere in the world.
Boy, that is some fascinating concept.
Oh, there's no doubt in my... See, Art, from being able to sit in this pyramid, and, you know, because I can travel dimensionally... And I don't say it like I'm Buck Rogers. This stuff happens to me, and there's nothing I can do about it.
I know.
So I use it for tools. You know, I've solved murders. I've found things. And
I know what you've done.
I see that when this triggers and it starts, we live in a new world. That energy will begin to raise everyone's consciousness. We will heighten our own sensitivity. People will become more intuitive. And to build up to that, why I like everything that's being built up to that is that we get a chance to interact. I get a chance at 48 years old to be a part of bringing back what I think is the Hermetic tradition, to bring back that true search and spiritual understanding mixed with understanding science and like a new reformation. And I think that every one of us who has a chance to take part in this and to become a part of elevating the consciousness and seeing what really is about to occur, it's one of the most dramatic events of my lifetime.
Well, that would be a worldwide spiritual event that a lot of people have been looking for, should that actually occur. That's an intriguing concept.
I believe it's going to happen.
Okay, let's put that in one hand, and then on the other hand, let's talk about the Middle East for a second, because in May, it's my understanding, we argue about the dates a little and may have them wrong, but in May, early May sometime, Yasser Arafat is going to say that the Palestinians are now an independent state. Moreover, Jerusalem is their capital. When they say that, all hell's going to break loose.
Well, it'll wait till May 13th. See, May 13th, because of... when Netanyahu's government collapsed over the Y peace agreement, okay, then they have to. Then what's got to happen? They have to reelect a new president.
Right.
Okay. So from that moment on, we'll see. You see, I believe that there's a peaceful resolution to this, and I think being a part of everything that we're doing and everything that we talk about, we can bring about a peaceful resolution.
But if we look down the road, on the one hand, there is spiritual enlightenment that may begin occurring with a capstone.
Oh, absolutely.
And on the other hand, there is the threat of the exact opposite that could occur in the Middle East.
I agree with you 100%, and I agree. And right now, you know, if you read Box 4 and 5 in Saved by the Light, it literally details the Oslo Accord, the Y River Accord, details that Jordan in itself will change.
I know.
But I believe, Art, and this is one thing I keep coming back to. I have seen the power of every little individual person and every big person and every medium-sized person and the power of their thoughts and the power of their prayers and the power of their identity to come to change. Y'all, you know, people on the radio and Art Bell Show and other places in prayer groups saved my life, and there's no question. And it was one of the most startling revelations to me I have ever seen at 47 years old.
Yeah, you're one of over a half dozen things we have done like that, and yours was the most important.
Well, Art, we've talked about setting up programs designed by Larry Dawsey to do prayer in groups across the country using the Art Bell Chat Club.
It works. Look, I don't preach to the choir here. I saw it work so many times, it scared me, Dan.
Well, I know how you are. Everybody, you're so wonderful, Art. And you know, when you see the power that the trust that people put in you and what we're capable of doing,
yeah.
Then we have the ability, I believe, like just following it up on the Egypt thing, the things that we're talking about, and to get people, keep them aware and keep them alert and keep reporting to them what's going on, that we control. It's not out of our hands. We can control and change destiny. I want that energy to raise. I want it to raise and bring back and open up so many sacred sites all over the world, just like them finding this place.
But the people who will argue with you, who did argue with you on the cruise when we did the great debate, and will argue even in stronger language, should I decide to go to Egypt and you decide to go to Egypt.
Right.
These people will say, Danian, come on, you're full of it. We know when when these structures were built. Zahi will say, I know how they were built. He will probably bring out a big piece of limestone and crack it in half.
Oh, sure.
To demonstrate to everybody. He will show the graves of those who built the pyramids. And the astronomers will say, no, it has nothing to do with any special alignment. They will argue with a Graham and a Robert Bovall, if he's there.
John Anthony Webb.
And there'll be a terrible fight about all this again. And
You know what's so fun about that, Art?
What's so fun about it, Dan?
The capstone will be put on there December the 31st.
And that'll settle the argument, huh? That'll settle the argument.
Here's all that stuff has occurred, okay?
I wondered myself, if I wanted to be at Giza when the capstone was placed on the Great Pyramid, and I forget who it was, a guest the other night, I asked him that, and he said, oh, no, I don't want to be there at that moment. No, thank you.
You know, Art, I'm kind of like that because...
Are you?
Well, the Y2K position worries me about traveling on those days and times. Why I chose to go on the May 8th period of time, because I'm there, I bring my heart and the people who come, and we bring a certain consciousness, and we plant that consciousness within the context of this debate.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that flying to Egypt... right around December 31st would be my idea of an adventure that I'd look forward to.
No, I'm not planning to do that. I'm planning to be home in my chair,
yes,
with my feet propped up.
Yeah, it's good for you.
And feeling that energy as it comes and being able to watch it because it's going to be televised.
Well, there is that energy, and then there is, I've got to ask you about it, Y2K. Boy, I'm telling you, Dan, from every source, I'm getting it. This is... It seems like it's real, Dan.
Oh, it's real.
Something real is going to come. There is going to be a great disturbance because of this Y2K thing.
I think that Y2K really is the point of the beginning of the change of consciousness. I mean, when you have a time-dated chip that they've known about for years and years and years.
Yes.
They've spent $850 billion to try to correct up to 40%. When Mr. Clinton, when President Clinton went on the air and he says Social Security is safe, and then he said because we've corrected it, and then he said 2,800 people have been working around the clock, 7 days a week, around the clock to correct this. Listen to what, and these people are making $200 an hour, man. Listen to what he just said.
I know.
Can this be a crisis? The Russians just asked for $3 billion
to correct
their missile system.
That's correct.
Okay, so nobody's being fooled. If anybody who sticks their head in the sand on this and doesn't prepare for this is a fool. I have no problem about it. Mm. I find very good things about it myself because it gives us a chance to, when they cut the power grids and, you know, like people... don't realize they get their electricity. We in South Carolina, we buy some of our electricity from Canada somewhere or New York, and the power grids and air traffic controllers and our defense systems and all those kinds of things. There's going to be disruption. And in disruption, at the same time we put this capstone on, then there will be a sense of consciousness and a whole renewal of ourselves, our kinship with our neighbors, our perspective about our government, our perspective about each of the aspects of our life, because it's about to stop,
okay,
to not be that way.
Again,
but
Dan, we come to the same exact juncture we just left a moment ago. We have that on the one hand. It may work out that way. A great consciousness change from the capstone to Y2K and what it brings. But on the other hand, there is a terrible fear that these people that you talk about that will come together in a loving way will instead end up shooting each other over food and rioting and looting and pillaging and raping and all of the rest of that that goes with anarchy.
I wrote about it in Saved by the Light and at Peace in the Light.
Yeah, that's over there on the other hand. So, I mean, I'm telling you, we got the extremes coming at us.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you something. There's no question that when you turn the electricity off and no food is delivered in New York City for like 30 days, look where you are.
It wouldn't take 30 days, Dan.
Oh, yeah. And then think about it from the aspect, if it's going to be the dead of winter, and it's going to be a freezing winter, and then you start looking at, you know, I write about it in Saved by the Light, especially dealing with literally where people are eating each other and the destruction that comes about in that. And then look at the third world countries are fare a lot better because they don't really have much, you know, you saw South Africa, you see where that is. But
if you're living on the land completely, then you hardly notice it.
But look at the countries Eastern Europe.
If you live
that are emerging after 70 years of communist rule.
If you're in an apartment in L.A. or New York or Chicago, boy, do you notice.
Oh, yeah, there's going to be no problem that we will notice that. But see, the Y2K combined, it's a time for everybody to look forward to taking stock in their lives and know that disruption is going to be a part and to get our heads out of the sand. Then there's also the other part. There is the Federal Emergency Preparedness Act. There's FEMA. Suspends the Constitution. The government takes possession of everything. It suspends the Senate. It suspends all your local representation. And the United States is divided into like 10 districts.
Well, I tell you, Dan, there's a lot of forks in the road, and they're not far down the road. I mean, they're just down the street a little bit, and we're coming up on them real quick. We're also coming up on the top of the hour, so we'll take a break and be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Somewhere in Time with Art Bell continues, courtesy of Premier Networks.
It sure is, and I'm Art Bell. And from Austin, Texas, Bob writes simply, "Hey Art, I am baffled and do not understand your feelings toward doing hospice work yourself." Well, that's Bob, because you may not understand me. Because I give light to all kinds of views on this program. Because I talk about all kinds of things on this program, people automatically assume that I believe all things on this program, and I don't. I believe things that I have touched and seen and can feel. I am bereft of the ability to take a leap of faith that has made so many of you out there comfortable. I'm giving you an honest answer, Bob, and so without being able to go to a bedside with the honest feeling that I knew exactly what was coming and could comfort that person, I don't think I could do it, Bob. So you asked an honest question, and I just gave you an honest answer. Maybe I'm more of a skeptic than most people out there think. It's a good forum, but it doesn't mean that I believe all that's on this forum, nor should you. It's just one of the freest, most open forums in the world, that's all. That's why you're here. That's why I'm here. And it is a long way home. Maybe not so far away either. Back to Daniel Brinkley. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Art.
I want to read you a fax I just got, and this takes basically the Hal Lindsey position, I think, fairly accurately, and I want to read it to you and get your reaction, all right?
Sure.
Here it comes. Art, the answer to your question, why does an obviously bad man experience City of Light, NDE, and a churchgoer experience hell? It was addressed by Hal Lindsey last night, you know. God loves man, his creation, so much that he became a man and died in place of man to pay the price for sin. You only have to accept that salvation to have eternal life with God in heaven. It is a gift. You don't do anything to earn that gift. You just accept it or you don't. Now listen carefully here. It isn't based on how good you are or how bad you are. God does not grade on a curve. One sin is enough to exclude you from God's presence. He is too holy. Sin cannot exist in his heaven. Only one man never sinned, and he was the one who paid the penalty for all. It's a gift. Terry Como, Seattle, Washington. Reaction?
I just don't buy it.
I think you did.
You can't get me to believe that, because the whole purpose, like, I mean, I've studied the Christian doctrine, and where that came about is that that your deeds meant nothing. You could only be saved by grace, which was initiated by the Catholic Church in an edict, I think, somewhere in the 15 or early 1600s, one of the papal edicts,
right,
that came about that you could only be saved by grace. And then the development of the split between Luther tacked the 99 thesis on the church door during what started the reform movement or the Protestant movement in it. But when your life passes before you and you have three near-death experiences and you see the panoramic life review and you know you're going to be every person that you ever encounter,
yes,
then the whole context of my life changed. I went from being the biggest jerk in the world to just a medium-sized jerk. And I started to care about... What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing because I know it's so true.
Yeah, it's true. You know exactly how I am, Art.
I do.
You know, and I see the difference that I can make in people's lives. This is somebody who doesn't do hospice work either. And it sounds to me like an excuse. This is so, and I'm not reflecting on anyone's religious belief. Everyone has a right to believe what they choose to believe and accept what they accept.
Right.
And that, but also have the right to open their hearts and minds to other people,
well,
have their opinions.
That's what I do here. I open it to everything. Now, here's one on your side. Dear Art, Danian is so reassuring. His broad mind brings more common sense than some may realize. Mr. Lindsey is a warm and compassionate man, but after listening to him last night and then Mr. Brinkley tonight, for me it's like going from a hot, barren desert to a body of peaceful waters.
That's wonderful.
So there you are.
And Art, when I come, I'm coming to do the Spiritual Odyssey, a program in Las Vegas that I do every year.
Oh?
And when I come down, I'm going to get you to come down with me, and you and I will go and visit a hospice patient. And we'll just see. I think it'll be a good idea.
I don't know if that's appropriate for me, Dan.
Well, think about it.
I will. But
we're all going to be volunteers for somebody we love, no matter what. But you know, I can appreciate it. A lot of people have problems with that kind of stuff, and I tried to create compassion in action so that we could help people deal with it.
I sure don't have problems with comforting the dying. I could do that, Dan, but I couldn't tell them what you tell them.
Well.
I couldn't tell them because you've got to understand that. I'll think about it, Dan. I'll think about it, but I don't know. We promised to go to the phone lines.
Okay, yeah, sure.
So here they come. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Daniel Brinkley and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
How you doing?
Another tricky day in paradise.
where are you at?
I'm in Los Angeles.
Ooh, is it warm over there?
Cold.
Cold. Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, I had a question about what can you say? I didn't get all the information about the site down here in Miami.
Well, that was
That was another earlier program, sir.
Oh, I know. I was asking, I want to ask him what he feels. I mean, he is psychic to some degree, correct?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, actually, good question, Dan. Go ahead. Say what you believe about this Miami site, whatever you think you feel.
Well, I think that this is a part of the beginning of us reawakening. This site is very, it's important. I remember the study of the Indian tribe that they flourished in around 600 A.D., and when the Spanish came in early 1500s, they killed them all off and made slaves and gave them diseases. But I looked at all that information, and I looked at how the layout, the way the astrological configurations, and I believe that this is another one of those places that proved there were cultures. There was a culture that had to exist before our culture, and that a lot of the things and a lot of the ability to construct these things came from there. And I think maybe that someone wants to stop this or wants to pave over it or just move it because they're maybe aware of what happens. Art had a show called Forbidden Archaeology.
That's right.
And a guy who discovered certain aspects that messed up the history of anthropology and archaeology, they just kind of pushed them to the side. But I believe this is just another one of those great sacred sites. Now, I'm a lot like Art in what's going to happen to it, and I think that the attitude that we had better take is how to photograph it, do a lot of maybe a satellite photograph with NASA or one of the space agencies or one of the intelligence agencies to photograph this site and mark it down and then measure it because, you know, I doubt that they'll be able to preserve it. But I think there's something wondrous about it.
All right. I hope they can preserve it. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Daniel Brinkley and Art Bell. Hi.
Oh, good morning, you guys. I'm so happy to talk to both of you.
Where are you?
I'm in Denver.
Denver.
Name is Debbie. Mm-hmm. It's
Hi,
cold
Deb.
Here. The wind is taking roofs off of houses.
Oh, my.
Daniel, I've got a friend who just gets as much from the sound of your voice as he does from the things that you say. And
Dan?
I'm sorry?
What does that mean? I don't understand. He likes hillbillies?
He just takes great comfort and joy in the sound of your voice and the way that you know, your phraseology. He's a bliss bunny when he hears your voice.
Well, tell him I love him. What's his name?
His name is Jeff.
Hi, Jeff. I hope this brings you peace and bliss.
I'm sure Will would giggle, too, probably, if he's listening.
Art does that to me. He makes me a bliss bunny.
So I've got a couple of things that I want to say, and I've written them down so that I can be brief. First of all, I'd love to send you $5 or something, Daniel, if you can give an address for me and probably thousands of other people to do that.
I mean, from the bottom of my heart, it's compassion in action. I mean, because, see, we're a purely volunteer organization. We're purely volunteers. And so, you know, I don't like to have people for money, but I'm not afraid to ask them, and I'm just really thankful. So thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you for all of the great stuff that you're doing. I wanted to say a couple of things about the NDEs. And in you know, good things happening to bad people and vice versa. And, you know, understanding is such an important aspect of compassion. And I think that when good people have bad experiences and vice versa, that really provides a cornerstone for compassion in their lives, and that when they come back, they have a balanced place to come from and to take action from. And what you do when you go into the hostels is incredible. And If people don't feel that that's always appropriate for them, I think it's good to remember that we can all afford to be a little bit more kind in our interactions with each other, just in general.
Because we're going to be that person, Deb. And see, we have first breath and last breath. We have a section called, I believe that the breath is the power. And so we have what's called the cuddlers also, where babies who just come into this world, crack babies and think children who just come into this world, we have a section where, that goes and holds children and puts love around children. It's just I don't particularly like children. They drive me crazy.
Yeah, I don't
and
like
I like to talk to people. I'd like to say one other thing to everybody.
I'm
please make those checks to CIA and not to Daniel Brinkley. Make them to Compassion in Action. But I think that the power of the breath, the first breath or the last breath, and if we care about those coming into this world and we care about those leaving, then those of us who are in the middle become strengthened. We have better vision, better hopes, better dreams, and better aspirations because we just added this one more. We put one more step toward all of us loving each other in this world.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. My chiropractor says that she sees older people, and the only physical contact that they get is when they're in her office, and it just breaks my heart.
I know, I hear that all the time.
But you see something to remember. Just like art, what art allows me to talk about, he lets me talk about, like everyone else, supposed to talk about issues. But we're making a difference. Just you talking and you calling and art being able to talk about it, people will venture. People will venture out. They will hunt their local hospice. They will start looking at this. They'll look at the rights because we're having to make decisions about our moms and dads and brothers and sisters. It's not a time to. It's not something to ponder. It's time for action. And the more we understand that the process called death, the more we can truly empower ourselves to live life. And I'm trying. That's what I try to do. You know, I'm a guy who has a pretty good time, and you know, I have a lot of fun in my life, although it's very limited now because of all the crap I've been through. But I want people to love this life. I think it's a great opportunity that we come to be co-creators and to live every moment and every day with as much joy and intensity and study and learning that we can possibly can.
So in other words, it's not like life's a bitch, then you die.
No, life's wonderful, and, you know, Art, look at the stuff I've been through, and I just love every day to wake up.
Giving you a hard time, Dan. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dan and Brinkley. Hello there.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hi, this is Deborah in Las Vegas.
Hi, Deborah.
We've got a lot of Debs on the phone tonight.
Yeah.
Danian, I have an unusual question for you. I have a snake that's 26 years old. It's a boa constrictor.
Uh-huh.
I've had him for a long time, and he's not well, and the vet does not know what it is. I'm wondering if intuitively you can pick up anything that I could treat him with, because I've been treating him myself.
Listen, one thing we don't do on the air is readings.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't ever, animals are not something that I pick up.
Oh, no.
They're not something, I mean, I know that they exist in a form on the other side, but children under 7, I usually know nothing about them.
All right, well,
under 14, I have difficult picking up. But from 14 to whatever age, I can perceive it. But
that's interesting. I don't. There are a lot of people capable of doing readings on the air. You're one of them. I know it.
Oh yeah, easy.
I'm about to have another on Friday night. This Friday night, you may know her, Sylvia Brown.
Oh, she's wonderful.
She's going to be here Friday night, Saturday.
Everybody, please listen to that show. Sylvia Brown. I've met her a couple of times. She's a lot of fun. She has kind of like the same personality as me. Because we don't take people pushing us around, and Sylvia Brown is absolutely wonderful.
I don't do readings on the air. I talk about these things. I think it's fascinating for the masses to talk about them. But when you do individual readings for most people out there, it's really boring. I mean, that's something you do if you wish to volunteer to do it on your own time. But I don't think it's proper for broadcast.
Well, I don't know. 26-year-old boa constrictor, I'd be. You know, I don't know, but you know, I'm glad you had them for as long as you had them, and you know, everybody pray for the boa constrictor.
Yeah, and boa will live on in your mind.
I'll see you at the spiritual oddity, Deb, and bring him over, and I'll do a laying on of hands.
Oh my God! Wild card line, you're on the air with Danian Brinkley. Hello.
Yeah, hi Art and Danian.
Hi.
Yeah, Art, I can understand your apprehension to enter.
Who are we talking to?
Oh, I just wanted to make a comment.
Well, yeah, who are we talking to? He's got a good point. What is your name?
David in Kansas City.
Okay,
hi, David.
Yeah, well, the reason I'd be a little apprehensive for hospice work is that I wouldn't want to give secondhand knowledge, and Daniel, it's easy for you because you are confident that it's firsthand knowledge to you.
Yeah, see, that's exactly what I've been telling him in sort of a less elegant manner.
But you see, listen, guys. Hospice doesn't, you don't have to tell them there's an afterlife. You can tell them that you don't know.
they need to process the end of their life. They need somebody to listen. They need to go back through a lot of things. It doesn't just require being able to tell a person there's a life after death. It requires that there's a quality of their life right then, and that you've come to bear witness to that fact so that they can process. A lot of people who are just by themselves and they're lying in a hospital bed or in a VA, they got no one except to keep boiling that stuff over in their minds. You walk in and you just sit down and let them talk. You'll be amazed at what you learn, and you'll be amazed at what that person got to process, something that you could just think about. I have a lot of hospice friends who I never bring up the afterlife. I never even bring it up because I'm not trying to push anything on anybody. I want that person to know that the dignity of their life and who they are is appreciated. And that's what, you know, we train volunteers. We train people how to handle every type of situation. And so you know when to shut up, or you know when to bring up something, or when not to. I mean, this is... One of our parts of our training is how to be a good listener. And it doesn't, you know, the quality and the dignity of that person's life means something, and they have somebody to help vent it. And maybe, you know, a lot of times you hear about what they wish they had done and if they could live their life over, and there are questions that you can ask, but that person really gets to review their life, and you never talk about it. You can just say, look, I don't know if there's a life after death. I just want you to be able to tell me your life story.
Yeah, but I would want to be able to say that, Dan. I would want to be able to say that, that I have knowledge. That's the kind of comfort you can really give to somebody. You've been there and back. I haven't. This caller hasn't. And so you've got to shift your perspective a little to understand the hesitancy that we would feel in that kind of situation, not being able to give the kind of assurance that you can give. Tough. It's tough.
You know, you're right, Art. I agree.
All right.
I mean, I have to agree.
I did have a question for Danion, though.
Fire away.
Danion. I'm not going to get the drug's name on the air because Art never has. But the drug that many neurologists use.
Drug X, we'll call it.
Yeah.
For near-death experiences.
Sure.
Scary stuff, Dan. What about it?
Well, can I elaborate a little bit?
Yep.
It blocks brain receptors for the neurotransmitter glutamate. And my thought is that it does alter consciousness to mimic the NDE. What I am afraid of, and I think that you can probably express it, is that other than just an altered state of consciousness, 'cause death, that may be near death in its pure semantics, but what about death where rigor mortis sets in and it would actually take cells to rejuvenate? Has anybody ever really been there?
Okay, we're going to have to, only one, according to...
Well, Lazarus, there's two.
Yeah.
I mean, Christ called Lazarus from the tomb. There's a lot of symbology in that, is the story of Lazarus being raised from the dead. That's not really literally the event of raising him from the dead.
Dan, hold it there. We got a break. We'll be right back.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from February 10, 1999.
Can you imagine being in a green room, that little waiting room before you go on a TV show, and hearing an astronaut's handler tell him what he can't talk about? Can you imagine that? First time for that one tonight. Danyon Brinkley will be right back. Listen. Preparation. For what? I don't know. Y2K? Gonna have Gary North on at the end of next week. He'll tell you about Y2K. And if it doesn't come on by itself as a problem, we may create it ourselves. Who knows? I don't know. We'll talk about that. It's a kind of an interesting aspect of the whole thing. I'm going to read you something that I hope I don't get in trouble for reading you, but I'm going to do it whether I do or not. It's to Ann Landers. It appeared in Ann Landers' nationally syndicated newspaper column. November 11th, the world observed the 80th anniversary of the end of World War I. 80 years ago on that date, a reporter wrote, last night, for the first time since August, in the first year of the war, there was no light of gunfire in the sky, no sudden stabs of flame through darkness, no spreading glow above black trees where for 4 years of nights human beings were smashed to death. The fires of hell had been put out. Those who put the fires of hell out were our nation's veterans. All Americans owe eternal gratitude to them. Not only those who fought in World War I, but those who served in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, and so many others. Our veterans have always responded when their country called, no matter what dangers they had to face, no matter what trials they had to undergo, and I might add, no matter what kind of war they were told they had to fight. Ms. Landers, this goes on, every year America's hospitalized vets look forward with great anticipation to your Valentine's for Vets program. By sending them Valentines from all over the world, your readers show hospitalized veterans that we are still grateful for their service and their sacrifices in 1999. The Department of Veterans Affairs, VA, National Salute to Hospitalized Veterans will be observed the week of February 14th through the 20th. Your readers can mail their Valentines to their nearest VA medical center, or they can be personally delivered. For the location of the nearest facility, readers should check their local telephone directory. They can also get addresses at the department's website, www.va.gov. It's signed, thank you for your loyal support of our nation's veterans. Sincerely, Togo D. West, Jr., Secretary, Department of Veterans Affairs, Washington, D.C. Here, once again, is Danyon Brinkley. Dan.
Art.
Yes. Final segment here. And here we go. First time caller line, you're on the air with Danyon Brinkley and Art Bell. Good morning. Where are you, please?
Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Okay, you're going to...
I can't hear her.
I know. I was about to tell her to yell at us. Yell at us, hon.
Okay, Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
That's better.
And your name?
Barb.
Hi, Barb.
Hi. I got a couple questions for you. When you do your life review, when you pass on, does that take very long, or...
Well, it takes... Remember on the other side... Where's the other side? But when you're there, time really doesn't have a time and space don't really have a meaning like we have now in dealing with the nature of quantum, you know, quantum dynamics and quantum physics. On this side, we have to have space and we have to have time. Your life review goes by in seconds,
but it's the same as it, you go back through your every day, every life, every breath you breathed in and out, every thought that you had, everything.
If you had a life like Daniel, it's like an eternity.
Trust me. And listen, three times I've had to go through the first 25 years. You know, they don't, like, let me skip over a part, Barb. I have to go back through that same stuff every time. So, and, you know, I'd like to say something else. I would really like to have a near-death experience, not from being hit by a car and what that young lady went through, but to be able to go and see these places and these levels and then go to the light and know that she could stay there, and then to go back and check out hell again, and then to ease on back to the world sounds like pretty cool to me.
Get to a computer and listen to that, Dan. I'm going to. Young lady, did you hear that young lady the other morning explain that near death?
No, huh?
I'm sorry.
You just like it when I'm on, huh, Barb?
Well, then you've got to go listen to.
Yeah. Another question. Does God allow the loved ones, say there's turmoil here on earth, does God allow the loved ones to come back and check?
Oh, sure.
And if there's turmoil now, and the loved one, see, I lost my mother 4 months ago.
Oh, but heaven gained her too, Barb.
Yeah, and I'm glad. I'm very, very happy.
Oh, good.
I accepted that. It's still hard on me because I miss her, because I loved her dearly.
Oh, yeah, but remember, we all grieve. Don't let anybody tell you how to grieve. I mean, you take your time. You miss her. You can cry when you want to. You can laugh when you want to. But try to do this for me. Make you a list some afternoon of the funniest things that you ever saw happen between the two of you, or the funniest things she ever did. That is the key to be able to keep in close contact. It's not the sadness or the loss. It's the humor, the funny things of the lightness. And when you want to pull her close to you, pick a certain day or time, like her birthday, or a time you guys had special to you, and think of the really funny stuff that went on between the two of you, and the senses of humor. And I always remember the sense of humor and of a person, and I can stay connected to them.
Hmm.
Another thing, we're going through a lot within the family now. I have two brothers that are totally destroying what family we have left.
Happens a lot.
Happens a lot in America today.
The number one, Barb, the number one new legal field is probating wills and lawsuits dealing with probating wills.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's happening to a lot of us.
I mean, they stole my mother's, really, her last will. She didn't, I know she wrote it on a piece of paper and she left a cassette tape. This is what I feel in my heart. And they went in and stole that. And now we have to take them to court to bring justice and honesty.
Boy, you hit that one on the head, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, it's tearing. I mean, I don't sleep.
Let me give you a place, Barb. Watch. I watch it all the time. Remember. And this you can take as much comfort. Know this. They're going to have in their life review, they're going to feel the pain that they're creating, and there's no escape. What you look back in your life, because there's the laws, you know, like my lawyer, who's a really great lawyer, he has a sign on the back of his, behind his desk. It says, justice is in heaven. Down here, we just practice the law. And that's the way it is. But by keeping your heart pure and clean and keeping the value of your mom, and know that they're going to have that life review, and they're going to feel every bit of it, and let it go. Find a new family, a new sense of family, you know. Call Compassion in Action if it's in your town, or come join another family that, you know, hospice volunteers are some of the most wondrous people. But don't let that eat at you.
Yeah, that's really good advice. That's really good advice.
Don't let it eat at you.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Daniel Brinkley. Good morning.
Hi, Art and Daniel. How are you?
All right.
This is Greg from El Cajon, California.
Yes, sir.
And your name?
Greg.
Hey, hi, Greg.
Hi, Danny. And I can't tell you how pleased I am to talk to you. I've tried many times and failed.
Oh, well, thanks.
Did
I make you a fuzzy bunny when I talk?
What's that?
Like that lady said earlier, I'll make a fuzzy bunny out of you. Or
somebody said something earlier that, when they heard my voice, it was like a fuzzy bunny or something.
I wouldn't use that phrase myself.
When whatever it was.
When the show first came on, my my wife adores your works, and
thank you.
She says that sometimes when she just thinks of you, she gets misty, and I think it's wonderful, the feeling that you've brought to her and to me.
Oh, thanks, Greg.
Daniel, the question that, it's not a question, but it's an experience that I had back in late 93. It's something that I've wanted to ask your opinion about for a while. My father-in-law had died, who I cared and loved very much. I was very close to him. Matter of fact, as far as a man goes, I admired him more than anyone I've known. Mm-hmm. And I knew him for such a very short time. I married my wife in 89, so I knew him for maybe a little over 5 years total.
Oh, but he gave you a good piece of advice when you were going through your job change.
Well.
When you were getting ready to go through were changing jobs, and the insight that he gave you in that, I can pick up things about that.
Yeah, you know, Daniel, that scares me. You're right.
And that's what gave you that strength so that you two became bonded. And
Daniel.
Okay, I'm sorry.
The thing that I called to ask you about was this. Shortly thereafter, he died.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a good man, and this is something that's always troubled me. And maybe it was something that I got mixed up in a dream or not. Maybe you can clarify it for me. But it was one of the few dreams in my 34 years of life that I can remember. Maybe it's one of three.
Okay, tell me.
In this dream, I was with him. And I've never had a near-death experience, but I was actually with him after he died, and it felt very real. He and I.
This is the dream, or this is you with him?
Well, I know I was in bed because I woke up after.
Okay, so
over.
In the dream you were with him?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And he and I were, it was all white. It looked like almost a cafeteria, but there was no one there but he and I. And we both had like a white robe type material, yet we were communicating with each other but not speaking.
Telepathic.
Wow.
And the thing that was, Daniel, is I asked my father-in-law, I said, well, where are we? And we just started to walk. And I remember very vividly walking down this hallway, and there was these windows. And outside I could see a terrain that was of reddish, and the atmosphere was a purplish-red type atmosphere.
I know where that place is.
You do. Hey, let me finish because it's so. This is.
Let me tell you something, Greg.
Yes, sir.
This happens a lot.
It does.
When a person leaves, usually in the dreamlike states, which are the states the Greek call the hypnagogic, just before you go to sleep or just before you wake up,
okay.
They can come to you in this state, and they can spend time so that you know they're safe and they're peaceful. Literally, 66% of all. Spouses have some form of contact with their departed loved ones. There was a great book written by Melvin Morris called Parting Visions that when you read it, you will hear people describing just what you're describing.
Yeah.
I have little doubt that that was him coming back to make sure you had certain comfort and because of the closeness with you and you would know it was peaceful. Ask your wife if she's had anything similar to that.
Well, she has with her mother, but the thing is, Daniel, is that the lead to the next thing is that he and I went down and we sat down in a room, an all-white room once again, and there were pews, very few. It was a very small room. I never saw anybody's faces, but they were all dressed in the same type of garment. And there were these speakers on the wall. There was some foreign tongue coming out of them. I had no idea what it was. It was like garble to me. And my father-in-law was just looking down at me. And then he and I walked back out, and I asked him, I said, well, you know, if this is heaven or a good place, I said, I don't really understand what I'm seeing. And he told me, he says, I'm really not sure if this is. And then he mentioned to me that something along the lines of that, you know, you better straighten out some of these things in your life. I don't know if I want you to end up like me. This is something that was very confusing.
Yeah, but here's a way. You know, he's already gone seen the Panoramic Life Review. A lot of people, you know, when Art was talking earlier about ghosts or discarnates, a lot of people don't really, not a lot, but some don't want to go to the light. Some pick places where they go in refuge or they go to face themselves.
That's what I think, too.
Yeah, I mean, and you go to these levels. There are so many dimensions on the other side. I mean, I'm aware of those levels because I've been able to, you know, see ghosts. I used to be in the ghost-busting business, but
yeah,
I got broken of the habit.
Hey, you know what? You know what, Dan?
What?
I've got a picture I want you to see. It's on my website now. Next time you get a computer, you've got two reasons to go to my website. One is...
Well, here's a little girl.
Yep, yep. And the second is, Dan, there's a photograph I got 2 days ago that Ramona handed me that was sent in the mail. And the photograph is of a car crash. It was somebody... there were several people in the car, and the person who was driving tried to avoid hitting a deer in the road. And they demolished the car. Dan, there's a picture of the car up there on the website. It is totally, utterly, completely demolished. You look at that car, and there's no way that anybody walked away alive from that car. Truth of the matter is, Dan, everybody walked away without a scratch. And then there's one more thing in the photograph, Dan. There's an angel.
A guardian angel.
There's a guardian angel in the photograph. It is one of the most impressive photographs I've ever seen in my life. It's on my website now. So
I can't wait. Cause,
please.
Oh, I will look at it because I believe these things. See, I see archangels, and or not archangels, but I see great spiritual beings around people. I see people's guides around them a lot.
This photograph was taken by a professional photographer, you know, who takes pictures of accidents, and it was about to be discarded, and this young lady picked it up who sent it to me. Her name and address and everything is up there on the website. You look at that picture. I want your impressions of it, all right?
Okay, no doubt. But let me, Greg, remember this. He was in a state, and what you have to do is maybe not end up like him, but to help you do better. When he said straighten out your life, it gave you a chance to go back and review your life. Because wherever this place was, he was in an in-between state, deciding about what to do with what he had seen about himself. I know the place. I mean, I know where that place is because it's where you forgive yourself and you really process all the stuff in you as a spiritual being, not as a human.
Or maybe, Daniel, where you don't forgive yourself.
Yeah, well, I didn't forgive myself. That's why I ended up back there in 1989. What a fool. You know, I've gotten over that too, Art.
Of the Rockies, we're almost out of time. Okay. You're on the air with Daniel Brinkley and Art Bell. Hi.
Hi, Art. And hi, Daniel.
Hello.
And God bless you both, by the way.
Where are you, sir?
It's Mike in Chicago, WOS.
Yes, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Daniel, earlier you mentioned that when you were in one of your experiences that you could sense being in different realities simultaneously.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember how many?
Well, I was in four simultaneous places. I mean, I believe there's up to seven. But when the two first near-death experiences, the lightning and the heart surgery, I could sense dimensions on the other side. But in the third near-death experience where I had brain surgery, I was aware that we are four complete different, it takes four complete different bodies of consciousness, and that we operate, since our physical self and our mental self deals with preservation or gratification, and they're so supportive of each other, we forget the other levels. But these two dimensions, I was living in a what you could call it a past, the present, but in other dimensions, other places as real as this physical world that we live in now. And it wasn't, you know, I'm still exploring this. Because I'm not really sure. I write about it, and if it's true, but
it's like
me trying to figure it out.
Was it like different personalities? Or?
No, same personality, but we are working. We're not just here. We're in four different places, different spectrums or levels of consciousness, doing just as much there as we're doing right here. I mean, we are multifaceted, multidimensional spiritual beings operating in multi levels of consciousness. I know it gets confusing.
Well, you can hear that from Daniel Brinkley, or you can hear it from Michio Kaku, one of the nation's leading bright theoretical physicist minds. They both say the same thing about the dimensions.
Wild how wondrous and how magnificent life is, and the nature of us as true, powerful, and mighty spiritual beings.
Oh, yes. No question about that. Well, Dan, we're out of time again.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed it, and I'd like to tell everybody I thank them. I love them very much, and thanks for comparing about thinking about compassion in action in their thoughts, and make sure they come to Egypt.
Dan, have a good morning. Get some sleep.
I'll do it, and I'll be at the hospice. I'll be at the hospital all day with veterans, so everybody. And thanks, Art, and tell Ramona hello, and just all the Art Knots out there, thank you for your support and your love.
Take care, my friend.
You too, brother.
That's Daniel Brinkley. All right, folks. That is it. Well, all right. Tomorrow night, Brad Steiger is going to be here, and we have quite a surprise for you. Indeed, quite a surprise. Tomorrow night, Brad Steiger from the High Desert. For now, that's it. Good night.